You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It's my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, John Hanrahan. John is currently on the editorial board of Expose Facts at exposefacts.org, which I should mention is an organization that rootsaction.org, which I work for, has worked in collaboration with. John Hanrahan is a former executive director of the Fund for Investigative Journalism and a reporter for The Washington Post, The Washington Star, UPI, and other news outlets. He also has extensive experience as a legal investigator. Hanrahan is the author of Government by Contract and co-author of Lost Frontier, The Marketing of Alaska. He has written extensively for NeimanWatchdog.org, a project of the Neiman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. John Hanrahan, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Glad to have you on, and a fascinating topic we have to discuss, which is coming out of a couple of lengthy articles that you've just published at truthout.org about the online activist group Avaaz and its push for essentially for war, and specifically for no-fly zones, first in Libya and then in Syria. First of all, just a basic idea. What is Avaaz?
Well, it's Avaaz is an organization that's based in New York. It has over 43 million members worldwide. In fact, its membership in the United States is only roughly 2.5 million. So it portrays itself as a worldwide advocacy organization that launches a lot of campaigns. And I should add in here, I would count myself as one of the 43 million members, or they count me as one of them. Anybody who has ever signed one of their petitions, and they've grown by incredible leaps and bounds by piggybacking. Somebody sends you a petition, four people sign it, and then you're on their list. They've had a number of, before we get to the no-fly zone, they've had a lot of what I would consider very good, admirable petitions, which I'm sure that I signed some of them myself, including ones that supported U.S. government whistleblowers, including Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. And they were one of the big organizers for the People's Climate March in September 2014. They recently had a petition that called on members of the European Parliament and leaders of the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Germany, and France to suspend all arms deals with Saudi Arabia until they end their assault in Yemen and begin a genuine peace process. And in fact, European Parliament did call for such an embargo. Now it's up to the various nations to try to implement that. I only say that by way of that maybe I was, a little not paying close enough attention, but I was startled, I guess, to see last June this full-page ad in the New York Times sponsored by Avaaz, which called for a no-fly zone in Syria, and they were running it simultaneously with an online campaign, which the New York Times ad called more on President Obama, but the online campaign called on several leaders to do this, and they had gathered well over a million signatures to support this no-fly zone. And I should say, when you go to their website, they don't sort of feature this. You know, the opening page, the home page doesn't, feature this as one of their main campaigns. You have to do a little searching around. I frankly don't ever recall getting such a petition from them. But in any event, it's this seemed to me, and probably to other people, so out of sync with how they were otherwise portraying themselves as a progressive organization that was that had sending out petitions to people worldwide, organizing against AIPAC in Washington, doing prominent things in the BDS movement in London. So, you know, there was a lot to recommend them. And their biggest membership, as I said, the United States is only 2.5 million. There's a number of other countries where they have, I'd have to look up the figures, but it seemed to be in Brazil there were over 8 million members. Germany had, I think, roughly the same as the United States. And until I started doing a little research on them, I had always assumed they were based somewhere else, like London, because they do have, you know, probably hundreds of petitions a year, only a fraction of which really apply to the United States. Or our foreign policy in other countries, or our militarism in other countries.
It seems to me, John, that when individuals and organizations generally tend to be for peace and occasionally back what they think of as a good humanitarian war, in many cases I could name in terms of Libya 2011 or Syria more recently or other examples, most peace advocates, most peace activists somehow avoid ever finding out that these individuals or organizations have backed wars and think of them as purely for peace, as good progressive groups. I mean, there are exceptions. I think when Amnesty International put up big ads in Chicago at the NATO meeting praising NATO's war in Afghanistan, a lot of people found out and raised hell, but it seems to be the exception. When you talk to people about Avaaz, Are they shocked and scandalized to hear that Avaaz promotes wars?
I think a lot of people that I have talked to, yes, were. I mean, you know, in some ways we treat this probably too casually. I mean, we see a good petition and we sign it and don't look behind closely at what the organization has stood for in other cases. As I say, if you go on their homepage, you'll see a lot of very meritorious campaigns. But yes, to answer your question, a lot of people said, well, yeah, I've signed their petition before. I didn't know. I thought a lot of people told me they thought it was an overseas organization, too, because it just because of the nature of some of the petitions that they received. But it does make you wonder. As I said, I readily signed a lot of these before. Since then, I've not been signing them. I don't know exactly what I've seen. You know, various bloggers online, some who said, you know, you really cannot sign another one of their petitions because what is their agenda? I guess is the question, and I'm wrestling with that one myself. What is their agenda here?
But to be out of their so-called membership, you probably have to unsubscribe, not just stop signing.
That's right. Yeah, no, you do. I mean, you sign one. They inform you at the bottom of each petition they send that when you signed your first petition. So they have and I suspect, you know, most groups do, they have a record of what you have signed and could probably then tailor what petitions they send to you. And perhaps my signing and some of the other people who were so shocked were ones that they had categorized as being peace people rather than humanitarian interventionists, so-called.
John Hanrahan, one further problem with these no-fly zones for Libya and Syria is that some people don't recognize that as a pro-war measure. In fact, Avaaz and others have started using the phrase safe zone, which sounds lovely and comforting. Can you briefly explain what a no-fly zone is?
Well, the no-fly zone, and you're probably more of an expert on this than I would ever be, but that it's essentially to I fall back, I guess, on the three generals of the U.S. military that I quote in the article, who warned that it does have such a benign sound to it. You know, you just sort of fly some airplanes over and you keep. And you keep the opponent's planes out of the air, and they can't do damage to civilians on the ground. Instead, and this was a little bit of an education for me, too, to see retired four-star General Carter Ham, who was the former commander of the U.S. Africa Command, who oversaw U.S. military enforcement of the Libya no-fly zone. So, you know, and generals are no shrinking violets when it comes to, you know, waging war and dropping bombs or shooting down planes. And he said, I worry sometimes that when people say impose a no-fly zone, there was this almost antiseptic view that this is an easily accomplished military task. It's extraordinarily difficult. Having overseen imposing a no-fly zone in Libya, a force that is vastly inferior in air forces and air defenses to that which exists in Syria, it's a pretty high-risk operation. It first entails, we should make no bones about it, it first entails killing a lot of people and destroying the Syrian air defenses and those people who are manning these systems. And then it entails destroying the Syrian air force, preferably on the ground, in the air if necessary. This is a violent combat action that results in lots of casualties and increased risk to our own personnel. And there's a couple of other generals who have made similar statements, including NATO's current Supreme Allied Commander and then former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey. So these are these are acts of war. These are violations of the territorial integrity or sovereignty of a country. These are not Abbas and some of the other advocates just make them sound like a walk in the park. You just go there and you fly some airplanes over and you have no problem after that. You're protecting civilians. And Abbas kept pushing this position even after the Russians entered with their planes late last summer, I guess it was. Abbas sort of doubled down on it, saying this was even more of a reason to have a no-fly zone. Now that the Russians were in there, seeming ready to provoke an even bloodier conflict there. Generals saying this, I don't ordinarily agree with what generals say, but they are about waging war, killing people, et cetera. And when the generals even say, this is not a good idea, you would think that people who advocate this would sit up and take notice. And one of my complaints with Avaz is that in the materials they did send out and on with their petition, they present no warnings whatsoever of this sort. I mean, even for those who might say, we've got to get more we've got to protect those civilians. But if they say, but you know, you can kill a hell of a lot of civilians too in the process of this, they make, when I queried Avaz about this, and they were very reluctant to answer any of my questions and answered only a few of them, but on this question, they said, well, we do provide a lot of links to online to places that do raise or do list a variety of viewpoints. Well, I looked at all those links, and they don't. They say nothing about these generals' warnings or other experts' warnings that this is a terrible and risky thing to do. So sort of rambled on that question, but it is something that they just have not been straightforward with, and it's almost like a disguise. This is a easy, wonderful thing to do. What they have done, as I mentioned in the or dwell on, I guess, in the articles, was that because some of their members spoke back to them about it, they put up a couple of different Q&As at different times during the Libya back in 2011-2012. And then last summer regarding Syria, that purported to answer the some of these questions and concerns about people, but it did not. They claim to question a lot of experts, but they don't name who they are. And Abbas, from the personnel, they're primarily not activists that started the organization. I mean, there were people who had overseas experience. Some of them now are, as we might mention later, one who's later became a congressman and is now with the State Department, one of their founders, Tom Perriello. And another fellow named Tom Pravda, who is the unpaid treasurer, is currently with the British Foreign Office. So they come at this from a more point of view of officialdom, I would say, albeit with some other good programs, good campaigns. The problem is, though, as I think with myself, who's usually more skeptical than I was with Avaaz, after a while, when you sign a lot of good petitions, you realize they're solid, they've got a lot of good information behind them, as you said, that the Roots Action would be a prime example, that you say, if they propose it, and it's probably pretty good. And in none of, I shouldn't say in none of their other campaigns, I don't know, because I don't, you know, read, I should point out that this is more geared to petitions that somehow or originate or affect the United States, because they have a Russian, a lot of Russian petitions. I have no idea what they're saying on those. They could be advocating for NATO to go in and attack them. I have no idea. But from the U.S. ones, the ones that are in English, they usually are, other than in these instances, are not advocating for violent actions. So they build up a certain degree of trust over the years. And sort of, if Avaaz says, their emotion is just palpable in some of these things. That if you know, we've got to do something. People, civilians are being killed over there. Why are we just standing here doing nothing? We've got to do something. Let's bomb them. And it's very. You know, you can see that they're just very frustrated by this activity, and they even sometimes pay lip service. We're usually nonviolent, but in this case, there's no other solution. And of course, if this doesn't work, what's next? Then drones or other bombing? I'm being facetious there, but that's what could come about.
We're speaking with John Hanrahan from Expose Facts and other organizations about his articles in truthout.org, and we will have them linked at talknationradio.org. John, I'm, of course, familiar with Tom Perriello, who was my congressman here in Virginia and a real lover of war, who backed every war dollar he could get his hands on, has been pushing wars ever since being voted out as well. It's worth pointing out that acts of war and murderous acts like imposing no-fly zones in Libya and Syria are actually criminal activity as well, that groups like Avaaz are promoting, blatant violation of the UN Charter, of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, of the sovereignty of the nation involved. ISIS, of course, doesn't have airplanes. This is not about taking on the enemy that the U.S. public has come to know and hate. It's about taking on the enemy that the United States government prioritizes, and that is overthrowing the government of Syria. So Avaaz has been, as you document, pushing the unsubstantiated and very dubious claims about chemical weapons use in Syria 3 years ago, and had been for some time cameras and so-called journalists in and out of Syria, and promoting all of that anti-Assad propaganda without, correct me if I'm wrong, without ever mentioning that anybody on any other front in Syria was killing or injuring anyone at all.
You can spot a phrase here and there, and usually it's when they also call for diplomacy in Syria. They sort of ride two horses at once, and when they're calling for diplomacy, they'll use some phrase like violence on all sides. But overwhelmingly, you're absolutely right. As I try to say in the article, this isn't a question of who's the most evil and who's killing the most people, but rather the type of information and propaganda that Avaaz is promoting, is promulgating here. And you mentioned Tom Perriello. Avaaz was really reluctant to answer most of my questions, but there were, I guess, three that they sort of answered directly. The others they sort of answered obliquely. But one was about a lot of bloggers online who have pointed to George Soros as a early funder of Oz as being, you know, as having some sort of continuing influence on the organization. He did his Open Society Foundation, and its predecessor give them about $1.1 million in their initial years, 2007 to 2010. So the question they answered with him was, we have received no money from George Soros or his foundation in any form since 2009, I guess they say. One of the other questions they did answer was on Tom Perriello, and they said he has had absolutely no involvement with the organization since 2009, late 2009. He was already in his first year in Congress then, so I don't know if he continued on the Oz board while still in Congress, but they, in any event, they said that he had no influence on their decisions regarding Syria or Libya no-fly zones. What I say in the article is that, but his certainly the Perriello spirit is there. Perriello wrote this really, as I say, creepy article in what is the publication? Trying to even remember the publication, but in which he says things like, and I'll just quote from that, we must realize that force is only one element of a coherent national security strategy and foreign policy. We must accept the reality, whether or not one accepts its merits, that other nations are more likely to perceive operatives to be self-interested than values-based. But in a world where egregious atrocities and grave threats exist, and where Kosovo and Libya have changed our sense of what's now possible, the development of the next generation of power can be seen as a historically unique opportunity to reduce human suffering.
He even wrote an article in which he praised the 2003 Iraq War as a model for future wars. If it had been done slightly better, there were errors in the execution. You know, let me ask you just very, very briefly, because I want to get to something else before we run out of time. Has Avaz commented in any way since the creation of the disaster in Libya on Samantha Power has said, don't look at Libya, so you'll be willing to bomb Syria. What has Avaz said, if anything?
No, that is one of the questions and follow-up questions that I posed to them. You know, did you, and I phrased it more diplomatically, but didn't the Libya experience chasten you at all about advocating for a no-fly zone in Syria? And I got back this answer, which was sort of saying, don't look back, look ahead. They sort of shifted the blame to their members, like these things bubble up from the members rather than New York staff people promulgate some petition. But they sort of said that no, you're asking a question about something happened in the past, which we are not applying to the future. I'm slightly misquoting what they said, but the gist of it was these are two different things.
Yeah, we should.
No, you don't learn from your past. And I was interested to note that that Bernie Sanders, a couple of times, including the past debate, did raise no-fly zone. Hillary Clinton defended it, but that the moderators, the questioners, never ask any follow-up, such as you asked earlier, what about a no-fly zone? What's
right.
Good about it? What's bad about it? Why, not even that. So it sort of breezes to the top, and I dare say a lot of people are somewhat mystified by what is a no-fly zone.
And Hillary still says Obama was wrong not to heavily bomb Syria in 2013, so we know where she's coming from and what she cares about the fate of Syria. But before we run out of time, you mentioned Roots Action, which I work for, and RootsAction.org was created to be an alternative to groups like Avaz and like MoveOn.org, which played such a role in creating Avaz, and websites like WhiteHouse.gov gov, which puts your name on a list for whichever big political party is controlling the White House at the moment. I mean, we tell people, don't do your do-it-yourself petitions at these sites. Don't sign the big petitions at these sites. Sign them and make them at rootsaction.org, because you'll be part of a movement that never backs wars, doesn't just have some good petitions and some bad ones, has only good petitions, and we'll never use your name to, you know, to raise corporate funds or promote horrible things. You know, you'll be part of a better movement. Is that smarter? Are we being sort of selfish and self-promotional? Should we sign the good of us petitions and not the bad ones? What do you recommend?
Yeah, well, I would have, you know, if I'd been asked this question about a year ago, I would have said, Avaaz has some really good petitions out there, and we should sign them. Now, as I said, since then, I continue to receive their emails just because I want to see what they might be up to. But I would generally recommend not to sign their petitions. I know the problem, I think, that some other very good groups that I know have, and on some occasions, worked in a coalition with Avaaz, and I think that's always a difficult thing for those organizations to navigate, I think. But from my own point of view, I'm personally not going to be signing them, and I'm going to, you know, tell other people through this article and other ways not to sign them. But it's ultimately, I'm copping out. Ultimately, it's up to the individual to see how, if they think they can somehow be effective with Avaaz. But I agree with what you said.
Well, and if there's a good idea for a petition and you can't find it somewhere you want to sign it, you can create it yourself at diy.rootsaction.org, and Roots Action will help you promote it.
On this score, if you have just 30 seconds, back in August of 2013, when it looked like Obama was going to unleash holy hell on Syria, the group, what is it called, Just Foreign Policy, started a do-it-yourself petition with a couple of other people, I think, and I think they may have started it on Avaaz, but they called on Avaaz to, you know, please send this out to all your members, you know, worldwide, we can get millions of signatures. When they sent that out, it was like September 5th, and Avaaz didn't respond, but what, it was only two or three days later that it became moot, I guess, for the time being. But they were not pushing Obama on a road to peace back then. They just ignored the issue. So anyway, it's when I found that out, I was even more chagrined that this was a group whose petitions I'd been signing for years.
Well, I appreciate, and I hope our listeners appreciate you opening eyes to the dangers of a group like Avaaz, and people can act accordingly. John Hanrahan with ExposeFacts.org and numerous other great organizations on your resume, and we will link to these articles at truthout.org. Thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, some variant on Obama seeks to repair frayed ties was the favorite headline for Barack Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia. The friendship between the two countries faces friction, media said, due to things like their threat to dump U.S. assets if made legally responsible for the September 11th attacks and the U.S.'s nuclear deal with Iran. But not because of things like the country's disastrous human rights record or anti-democratic government. What does explain the relationship CNN called an unhappy marriage? We'll hear from Sheila Carapiccio, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond in Virginia. Also on the show, Dilma Rousseff is facing impeachment, though the Brazilian president seems to be accused of a financial maneuver that would be familiar to politicians the world over, while many of her accusers are themselves facing corruption charges. We see images of anti-Rousseff protesters marching in the streets, but is the situation best summed up as the people versus the president, as one pundit had it? Maria Luisa Mendonça is director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights. We'll hear her thoughts on events. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. Some 36,000 Verizon workers went on strike April 13th, from Fios installers to customer service representatives, in protest of demands for what the union, the Communications Workers of America, called significant concessions with harmful community impact. These include more offshoring and contracting out and requiring technicians to work away from home for as long as 2 months, as well as high health care costs for retirees and reduced benefits for injured workers. It's kind of media criticism 101 that corporate media mute the voice of labor during strikes, and there's no need for a refresher course. A comparison of direct quotes from Verizon management and the union or workers on strike, including press release citations, FAIR.org's Adam Johnson found, showed a familiar pattern. When Johnson wrote on April 20th, the New York Times had done 3 stories, with management quoted 8 times to workers 4. In the Washington Post 2 reports, the ratio was 6-2 in management's favor. What about new media? Well, BuzzFeed's 3 articles favored the company 13-7, while Vox had just 1 piece at the time, with 4 quotes from management and none from workers. That kind of balance is just a snapshot, of course, with more complexity underneath. Part of that is journalists' relative lack of personal experience with unions, and another part is that despite the media's portrayal of big labor, unions' PR machinery is small potatoes compared to that of a behemoth like Verizon, with annual revenues of $131 billion. When the Washington Post and New York Times are making the same corporate-friendly point, it's safe to assume that some PR agency somewhere is earning its oversized check. In this case, the subject is the need for nuclear power. After favorite post-dartboard Bernie Sanders called the Indian River nuclear plant, 25 miles from Manhattan, a catastrophe waiting to happen, the Post editorial board declared April 18th, "If we are serious about global warming, we will ignore Mr. Sanders' sloganeering." That's because, quote, "nuclear accounts for about a fifth of the country's electricity, and it is practically emissions-free," close quote. Nuclear power is not emissions-free. The process of mining and enriching uranium fuel, along with constructing nuclear plants, operating backup generators during reactor downtime, disposal of nuclear waste, and eventual decommissioning of plants all contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. According to an analysis published by the journal Nature, nuclear power does produce 14 times less in greenhouse gas emissions than coal and 7 times less than natural gas, but twice as much as solar cells and 7 times as much as onshore wind farms. For halting climate change, in other words, there are more serious options than nuclear. The Post suggests we tax carbon and let the market find the fastest and most efficient road to slowing the warming of the planet. What's funny about that is if we had a market-driven energy system, there'd be no need to oppose nuclear power. If we didn't have the Price-Anderson Act capping industry liability for nuclear accidents, requiring it to pay less than 2 cents on the dollar of the projected costs, it's unlikely that another plant would ever be built. The next day, at The Times, it was Eduardo Porter defending nuclear as the only technology with an established track record of generating electricity at scale while emitting virtually no greenhouse gases. Here it's being defended against an even scarier foe than Sanders, the left, and its, quote, scientific and technological taboos, close quote. After bringing in Silicon Valley's Marc Andreessen, who says the left is turning anti-science, citing liberals' fear of genetically modified organisms and their mistrust of technology's displacement of workers in some industries, Porter compares the left's failure to accept the scientific consensus on nuclear power to climate change denial, because 65% of scientists in a Pew poll favored building more nuclear plants. Of course, there's a difference between an actual scientific consensus on the physical fact of global warming and a preference expressed by scientists for a particular energy policy. Conflating those two sounds like the opposite of what Porter claims to be advocating, which is, quote, somehow disassociating the scientific facts from deeply rooted preferences about the world we want to live in, close quote. Well, the Times column offered some preemptive criticism of its own analysis, quote, highlighting the left's biases may seem like a pointless effort to apportion equal blame along ideological lines, close quote. But it's not pointless. It's an effective way to sell pro-corporate policies under the guise of objective truth. And finally, April 20th marked the 6-year anniversary of the biggest oil spill in U.S. history, the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, which new research says was even bigger than previously understood, at least in terms of the amount of coastline that was oiled. That's noted in a piece on NationalGeographic.com, one of a very few outlets to note the occasion with reporting beyond a "this day in history" squib. Some media, like the New York Times, used the anniversary to give the White House a peg to release regulations they released in draft last year, aimed, we're told, at preventing equipment failures like those that contributed to Deepwater Horizon. New rules will tighten controls on blowout preventers. There will be more real-time monitoring of drill and spill containment. Government is proud. Some environmentalists are skeptical. The industry says it's too much. It's standard stuff, as if the paper forgets its own reporting on the ruling on Deepwater, in which U.S. District Court Judge Carl Barbieri cited not a lack of rules, but a failure to respect them, calling out the entire industry as motivated by profit to operate with conscious disregard of known risks. In a case where business as usual is the problem, journalism as usual can't be the response. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The New York Daily News cover is a photograph of Barack Obama with Saudi Arabia's King Salman and the headline, "Oil Protect You, Sire." It's far from elegant, but the paper's trying to say something about the relationship CNN likened to an unhappy marriage in which both sides, for better or worse, are stuck with each other. News of Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia changed by the hour. First, we were told things were chilly, then that they'd been smoothed over. But people who might want to understand more about the abiding goals of the U.S. alliance with a monarchy where women can't have bank accounts could easily remain confused. We're joined now to discuss the issue by Sheila Carapicho. She's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond in Virginia and a contributing editor of Middle East Report. Welcome back to Counterspin, Sheila Carapicho.
Nice to talk to you.
Well, state definitions of ally or enemy are defining, literally, for U.S. media. It might start out as strategic foreign policy talk, but ally and enemy fairly quickly become us and them, and feelings are directed accordingly. So it means a lot that Saudi Arabia is a U.S. ally. We're supposed to cheer for good relations with them. But why is that? What is the official basis for the alliance?
Well, you know, it's not, on a technical point, an alliance like NATO or something like that. Technically, it's more like a friendship or a relationship. And it used to be, and it's still fashionable sometimes to say it's really about oil. But I think that's really only part of it now. Saudi Arabia is also a very major customer for American weapons. This is Obama's fourth visit. There's only a handful of other countries he's visited more. Also, it was revealed recently that the Saudis were somehow threatening to withdraw their funds from the American financial system, which are significant enough that that sounded like a threat, although no one seemed to take it all that seriously. But the United States has, you know, as a whole, has a real vested economic interest in the relationship with Saudi Arabia and in maintaining our balance of trade with Saudi Arabia. So we do still import oil from them, but I believe that the amount that we export to them in weapons is even more. And then in addition, the relationship with Saudi Arabia and then also the other Gulf monarchies ensures the American presence, military and naval presence, in the Persian Gulf area, which I think is partly to protect oil, but also to make sure that, for example, the Chinese or other outside powers don't gain too much of a foothold. As your question implies, of course, I mean, there's no way that we would justify this friendship based on anything about their domestic policy, I mean, on gender, on religious or ethnic minorities, on freedom of speech, in terms of any semblance of democracy. I mean, none of those traits that we supposedly look for in allies or even friends characterize the Saudi kingdom whatsoever.
Well, that's why I see it as almost a kind of test of media's ingenuousness or willingness to appear so. I find foreign policy coverage difficult to parse because we see what happens in Saudi Arabia. We see them beheading people for witchcraft, for example. And
right.
And then the coverage calls it strange bedfellows, you know, or something. And it seems as though we have to have this relationship with, we have to, against our, you know, we have to hold our nose and have this relationship. And it's, I'm not being facetious when I say it's frankly difficult to understand the way it's discussed in the media.
Well, another aspect of that, which I think speaks directly to your comment there, is that they have a phenomenal lobbying machinery based, of course, in Washington that contacts the press and members of Congress and puts out all sorts of happy news stories about Saudi Arabia and their intent to reform. A colleague of mine, Bob Vitalis, who wrote a book about Saudi Arabia, pointed out that, you know, we've been talking about how they're getting ready to reform for like 40 or 50 years, mm-hmm. and they never do. There's a very, very well-financed propaganda machine, which is obviously very effective. I mean, you and I know about, for example, these beheadings for things like witchcraft, but it's remarkable how little real news comes from Saudi Arabia. It's very difficult to get a reporter's visa, press visa. You don't see Obama having a public speech the way he did in Cuba, for example, mm-hmm. and giving a press conference. I mean, that doesn't happen in Saudi Arabia.
Well, on the arms question that you mentioned earlier, William Hartung had a piece recently in the Times noting that in the first 6 years of the Obama administration, the U.S. transferred some $50 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia with the ostensible intent of improving security. And that, of course, leads us to Yemen and the Yemen offensive. You know, we always hear it described as Saudi-led but U.S.-backed. Is it possible to overstate the importance of the U.S. backing of that offensive?
I mean, it might be possible, but I certainly don't think that was an overstatement. I mean, you know, the U.S. is actively involved. They do mid-air fueling. The U.S. and the U.K. both, I might add, have increased weapons sales since the beginning of the Saudi intervention in Yemen. We've also, again, both the U.S. and the U.K. have fostered U.N. security resolutions that call on all the Yemeni parties to stop fighting but don't even note the Saudi armed intervention. Mm-hmm. And there's a tendency, again, in the press and in statements coming from the State Department to treat it as if it were a civil war, which is really not an accurate statement because there's a direct Saudi intervention. The vast majority of the civilian casualties, I mean, one doesn't have to have much sympathy for the people that they're fighting against, and I don't. But nonetheless, it is the case that both the civilian casualties and then other just dire circumstances, because there's also a naval blockade, so desperately needed, you know, food and fuel and medicine have not been reaching most people in the country. This is a war by one of the richest countries in the world against one of the poorest. Mm-hmm. And so it's really, it's not surprising, but it nonetheless is disgraceful that the United States would never once have called, for example, for a ceasefire or an investigation into what Human Rights Watch and other organizations have documented as, you know, disproportionate use of force, poor targeting, you know, and other things that Human Rights Watch says may very well amount to war crimes. We're aiding and abetting those.
We've been speaking with Sheila Carapiccio, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond in Virginia. Thank you so much, Sheila Carapiccio, for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The situation in Brazil, where President Dilma Rousseff faces impeachment charges spurred by legislators, many of whom are themselves under investigation for corruption, is hard to grasp at a glance. But glances are all we get in U.S. media. And when it comes to Latin America, elite media haven't been shy about their disaffection for leftist governments, sometimes going to great lengths to paint them as delusional and dangerous to the region and somehow to the U.S. So how do we assess the situation in Brazil without that particular filter? Here to help us with that is Maria Luisa Mendonça. She is director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights and a professor in the International Relations Department at the University of Rio de Janeiro. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Maria Luisa Mendonça.
Thank you very much.
Well, NBC's Chuck Todd retweeted an image of some of the people protesting in the street for Dilma Rousseff's impeachment, and it was labeled, "The People versus the President." And that's kind of the picture you get from a quick look at U.S. media. Is that a fair picture of what's happening in Brazil? What would be a clearer picture of events there?
Yes. That's not at all a clear picture. What we have been seeing in the media in the United States is a very simplistic version, basically saying that though there are accusations of corruption against the government and people are protesting against the government. What is missing is that there has been huge demonstrations in favor, in support of the government and against what we are calling a coup. This is not an impeachment because there is no legal basis for the impeachment right now. The president has not been accused of any corruption crimes, and the opposition parties themselves are the ones concerned with the recent investigations of corruption because the government gave more autonomy to the federal police, and several opposition leaders are being accused of having, for instance, hidden accounts in Switzerland, in offshores with millions of dollars. That has been documented. The accusation they are using against the president is that she used a type of budget mechanism to borrow from public banks and then invest on social programs in Brazil, which is a very common mechanism that is being used by other administrations, previous administrations in Brazil, by state governors. And every country in the world issues bonds to pay for social spending. The United States does this. So there is no legal basis for the impeachment, and there is a lot of support for the government. In fact, because the opposition has not been able to win elections in more than a decade, and they never accepted the result of the elections that happened just last year that reelected Dilma Rousseff, they are trying to subvert the electoral process and take power.
What do you think makes Dilma Rousseff vulnerable to this at this time? I mean, Brazil is in a state of real economic crisis at this point. Do you think that is what has created the opportunity for this to happen now?
Exactly. This is exactly what happened. Right after the elections last year, Brazil suffered speculative attack from the financial sector. Interest rates now have increased from 7% to more than 12%, almost doubled in the last 6 months. But there was no specific reason for the financial crisis. It was not like in the United States that there was a housing bubble. In the case of Brazil, it's pure speculation. There was not enough reason for suddenly the economy, we were growing one day and the next day we were in a financial crisis and the government had to double interest rates and start imposing austerity measures in an economy that was growing just the month before. So I think there was a kind of an orchestrated speculative attack to make the economy more vulnerable. And of course, there is also the interest of foreign oil companies because Brazil has huge oil reserves. And there is a fight and a debate now about the right of the state oil company, Petrobras, of having priority to explore the oil reserves, and there is a lot of pressure from multinational oil companies to be able to explore those reserves as well.
Brazil has has intense inequality. There is a real class division in Brazil, is there not? I mean, not that there is not in the United States, but it's quite pronounced, and it's important to understand that fact as we look at what's going on there today.
Yes, exactly. Brazil is one of the most unequal countries in the world, and our critique of the Workers' Party government was that they didn't go too far in terms of structural reforms. They were able to implement large social programs that made it better, the situation, the economic situation, than the inequality was better during those years, and unemployment was in a very low level. So the country was growing. There was a sense of optimism. There was more investment on education, on health programs, although, you know, there are lots of problems, inequality, poverty still. But they were implementing policies that the presence of the state in the economy was larger than in the previous neoliberal governments that imposed austerity measures and privatization. But now what we see in the future of what the opposition parties are defending is more austerity, more the kind of structural adjustment policies that we think that will make the situation even worse.
Glenn Greenwald pointed to the role of media in Brazil, if folks are getting some of their understanding of the situation from Brazilian media. And he noted that you know, if you think about the role that Fox News played in promoting the Tea Party protests, and then imagine that those protests were promoted not just by right-wing networks like Fox, but also by all the networks, all the magazines, the New York Times, the supposed alternative media, and that that, you know, is kind of what the media looks like in Brazil. What can you tell us about the role that the big media are playing within Brazil?
Yeah, that's a key role. All the major TV networks and newspapers are against the government. It's exactly how you described, as if you had only Fox News. Can you imagine that? And the Workers' Party didn't invest as much on alternative media, didn't deal with the problem of media monopoly in Brazil. More than 90% of the funding goes to about six major media conglomerates in Brazil. Just to give you an idea, the protests against the government were orchestrated by the major TV networks. They were reporting live all day and calling people to go to the streets and protest against the government. It was very open that they're supporting the coup. We are calling this a coup. And at the same time, when we had millions of people protesting against the coup, there was almost no coverage at all of that. So it's very biased, and they're very active to try to get rid of the president, really. That's what is going on.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, I understand that Dilma Rousseff is coming to the UN on Friday. I hear also that I think it's now 9 ministers in the cabinet have quit, including the sports and tourism ministers. This is 4 months before the Olympics. What do you see happening?
Well, the OAS, the UN, UNASUR, several multilateral organizations have expressed their concern about the process that is going to undermine democracy in Brazil. And we hope that the Obama administration and the U.S. government also would be able to voice their opposition to this process that we are calling a coup, because it's very similar to what happened in Honduras and Paraguay. So we hope that at this time the U.S. administration would play a positive role and would support the result of the elections that elected President Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, that should be respected.
We've been speaking with Maria Luisa Mendonça from Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights and also from the University of Rio de Janeiro. Thank you very much, Maria Luisa Mendonça, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
This event made us realize how poorly prepared we are to face these huge geological catastrophes.
About 12,000 years ago, there was a period of volcanic storms, so many erupted. The Earth was unstable, rocking and rolling with quakes. Geologists know that climate change destabilized the Earth's crust. Does that sound too fantastic? The weight of ice, miles thick, poured into the sea as the latest ice age ended. Released from that weight, the land rose, long-standing pressure points reacted, and the world shook. Now, after recent big quakes in Japan and Ecuador, with more underreported quakes around the world, some scientists are beginning to wonder if climate is starting to destabilize geology again. We'll talk with one of the world's best geophysical hazards experts, Britain's Dr. Bill Maguire, author of Waking the Giants. Even if that time of extra volcanoes and quakes is further into our future, the threat of everyday quakes and tsunamis is larger now. That is because so much of the doubled and tripled human population lives near the sea. We've built our megacities and nuclear power plants within tsunami range. 8,000 years ago, an earthquake caused an undersea landslide off of Norway. The tsunami raced around the whole North Atlantic, reaching up to 30 meters high. That's well over 90 feet. Adding to it all, we've globalized the economy based on a network of mega cities. Several of them sit on well-known faults that are bound to blow, with quakes well above 8 on the Richter scale. The most precarious is the financial hub of Tokyo, Japan. We'll talk about what happened the last time Tokyo was nearly leveled, and the next time, which Japanese scientists say is over 90% likely within the next couple of decades. The aftershocks would be in the world's shaky financial system. Would a big quake in Los Angeles, Vancouver, or Tokyo be the trigger for a massive economic collapse in the global world? That's why our second guest, Dr. Robert Yates from Oregon, wrote his book, Earthquake Time Bombs. We'll go into that risk in depth. I'm Alex Smith, as we shake up the world with Radio EcoShock. From Japan and then Ecuador, when major earthquakes strike, the media rush to Dr. William Maguire. He's a volcanologist and world-known specialist in extreme geologic events. Maguire is Emeritus Professor of Geophysical and Climate Hazards at University College London. Bill has advised the UK government on global threats and appears often on TV. Bill was also an author of the 2011 report of the IPCC regarding extreme events. His latest book is Waking the Giant, How a Changing Climate Triggers Earthquakes, Tsunamis, and Volcanoes. Bill, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
What is your recent take on the big quakes in Japan and Ecuador?
Well, to be honest, it's really just business as usual. I mean, these are not gigantic quakes. We would expect up to a dozen of earthquakes of this sort of size every year. So it's really nothing unusual. I mean, you see stress and strain accumulating on faults all over the planet all the time. And periodically, that results in a fault rupturing and an earthquake of this sort of size.
Are we entering a more intense geologic period, or do we just have better reporting and more cell phone videos?
Well, that's the thing these days, isn't it, that disasters and disastrous events are in the news sort of immediately. Everybody, none of these things can happen without people seeing them or filming them these days. We do have a variation in the numbers of earthquakes that happen every year and the number of volcanic eruptions that happen every year. But it's within the statistical noise, if you like. There's no not yet anyway, there's no obvious increase in either volcanic activity or earthquake activity. But that doesn't necessarily mean that our changing environment, that climate change isn't triggering certain events. It's just that we're not sure which ones those are, and we can't detect them against the general background of activity.
Right. You did put in your book, Waking the Giant, that climate change could possibly stimulate more activity from volcanoes. I have a hard time understanding how that's possible. How does it work?
Well, it's something that we've known for a long time by looking back in time, and it's there are a number of ways this can happen. One of them is where you have volcanoes that are loaded by a great thickness of ice. You have in Iceland today, and as you had right across Iceland, for example, in the past, when that load of ice melts, when it's removed, magma that's been unable to get out when the ice was sitting there can get out more easily. Also, if you take the weight of the ice away, you actually produce more magma underneath the crust in the Earth's mantle as well. That's one way we can do it. We can also do it in the case of volcanoes that are coastally located or form islands by changing sea level. If you change sea level dramatically, either up or down, then it creates quite big changes in stress and strain in the crust that can push magma out. So there's a number of ways this can happen.
What about the melting of ice, say, in Iceland that seems to be capping over some volcanoes?
Well, that is a big concern. If we go back something like 12,000 years, or go back 20,000 years, the height of the last ice age, Iceland was covered by a kilometre of ice, and that weight stopped virtually all volcanic activity. But when the ice melted, around about 12,000 years ago, there was almost a real, what's called a volcano storm. The rate of volcanic activity went up 50 times over a course of about 1,500 years. Now, Iceland isn't covered by a kilometre of ice today, but there is this big ice cap, the Vatnajökull ice cap in the east, and that is melting very, very rapidly. And modelling that's been undertaken suggests that as that melts, so we will see an increase in the amount of lava coming out and also in the amount of lava that's being produced underneath the crust. So, I mean, it's certain for a start that ice cap will melt because of the rate of temperatures rising, and we will see a measurable increase in volcanic activity. And we know, obviously, from the Eyjafjallajökull eruption in 2010, that just one moderate eruption on Iceland can create total chaos across the aviation industry.
And here is the question everyone asks you. Bill McGuire, do you think climate change is a contributing cause to the recent great quakes from Nepal to Japan?
Well, that's an interesting question. In terms of the Japanese earthquake, there was a recent Japanese earthquake and the one in Ecuador, there's no particular reason why we should think climate change was involved in that. The same really goes for the Nepal earthquakes, although there is a mechanism, a climate mechanism for triggering earthquakes in the Nepal region. And it's only been really discovered quite recently that when you have monsoon rainfall, that monsoon rainfall soaks into the sediment in the Ganges Plain right across the front of the Himalayas, and it compresses the faults there. And it seems that that compression is causing more earthquakes to happen in the winter months along the Himalayan, what we call the Himalayan front, than the rest of the year. So if you have a change in the monsoon, for example, as a result of climate change, then you may see some change in the controlling of earthquakes in the Himalayas. But the Nepal earthquake, the specific earthquake that happened in April last year, we don't have any direct evidence for a climate link. But then again, as I said, we may not necessarily see that.
You know, people are concerned with climate change, and we should be, but some of us have a hard time believing these latest quakes are not. Everything has to be connected to climate. But there must be a point where your theory does really kick in earnest. Do we know when that might be?
The thing is, all different faults that generate earthquakes right across the planet will be in different states of stress and strain. Some will be ready to go, ready to rupture, ready to generate big earthquakes. Others might have ruptured recently, and they may take centuries to accumulate enough strain to rupture again. Now, in terms of climate change, in terms of the stress and strain induced by the loss of ice, by rising sea levels, the faults that are going to be affected are those ones that are critically poised and ready to rupture to generate an earthquake. And all that's needed there is literally the pressure of a handshake to set those off. So those faults that are ready to go are the ones that are going to be affected. Now, we may not see an increase in the total number of earthquakes across the world, but you only need one or two major faults in built-up areas and urban areas that are ready to go. Only a few of those faults to be triggered by climate change, and you will have a massive impact.
What caused that great quake and tsunami off the coast of Japan in 2011?
That was simply tectonic stresses. In other words, the world's tectonic plates pushing against one another, accumulating stress and strain over a long period of time, and then rupturing, as they do every few hundred years in most cases, and generating a big tsunami. I mean, that earthquake was a submarine earthquake. Now, if you think about one of the triggers for earthquakes relating to climate change, is to do with sea level. But in those cases, as sea level goes up and the load of the water increases and increases, it will stabilize those submarine faults. They will tend to rupture probably less often. The faults that we should worry about are faults like the San Andreas that are parallel to a coastline, because where sea level rises there, next to those faults, it will bend them. It will bend one side of the fault and not the other, and that can allow them to move more easily. So we shouldn't be too concerned about submarine faults, but we should be a lot more concerned about faults that run across the land parallel to the ocean.
But I think this is one really important point you make, Bill. Because of tsunamis, listeners do not have to live in an earthquake zone themselves to suffer the consequences. Could you tell us about another couple of tsunamis, either in human history or the geologic record?
Well, extraordinarily, we've had two catastrophic tsunamis, as I'm sure all your listeners will know, the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004 and then Japan in 2011. That's really unprecedented to see them occur so frequently. But if we go back in the past, there's evidence of massive tsunamis right across the planet, not just in the Pacific. I think one of the most interesting formed about 8,000 years ago as a result of climate change, because after the ice sheets that covered Scandinavia, Norway and Sweden, started to melt, the crust underneath there started to bounce back up very, very rapidly because of the weight of the ice had disappeared. That triggered lots of big earthquakes. One of those big earthquakes triggered a gigantic landslide off the coast of Norway, one of the biggest known on the planet. That generated a tsunami which was up to 30 meters high in the north of Scotland. It came right down the North Sea into Western Europe, and it went straight across the Atlantic towards North America as well. Now, it's that sort of thing that we're worried about for the future, because Greenland is in a very similar situation to Scandinavia at the end of the last ice age. 2 or 3 kilometers of ice. That ice is melting already. The crust is already bouncing back up under Greenland. We know that from GPS measurements. If that uplift causes earthquakes, if those earthquakes trigger big submarine landslides, then we could see tsunamis in the North Atlantic again.
And there's a YouTube video where you introduce four major threats, and that's from another of your books, Global Catastrophe, a very short introduction. Could you just outline what those four threats are?
Yes, there's four really big natural threats, which I call global geophysical events, or GGs. There's the asteroid or comet impact. There's a volcanic super eruption. There's what I call a strategic earthquake, an earthquake that occurs somewhere that affects one of the big financial centers and therefore has a knock-on effect across the planet in terms of employment and jobs and economy and politics and this sort of thing. Tokyo is really the place I think of when I talk about that. And then the fourth one is a giant ocean-wide tsunami, particularly in the North Atlantic. And obviously the place I've been working for some time now is on the Canary Island of La Palma, where you have this huge mass of rock which is unstable and at some point in the future will collapse into the North Atlantic and generate a major tsunami. Now, that could threaten tens of millions of people around the margins of the Atlantic in North America and also in Europe. So those are the four things, really: super eruption, asteroid or comet impact, giant tsunami, and strategic earthquake.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Bill McGuire. He's the well-known UK expert on extreme geophysical hazards like earthquakes and volcanoes and even climate change. Yeah, you've talked about Tokyo as a city waiting to die. That's pretty extreme talk. Tell us more.
Well, in a sense, it is. I mean, not literally, I don't think. But Tokyo is in one of the most seismically active parts of the planet. In the 1920s, there was a catastrophic earthquake there which killed maybe up to 200,000 people. The fires after the earthquake wiped out much of the city. Now, today, Tokyo's population is several times bigger than that. It's something like 36 million people, extraordinary size. It's one of the major economic and financial centers on the planet. The big earthquake in 2011 in Japan actually stressed some of the faults that might affect Tokyo in the future and brought forward the timing of the next large earthquake to affect Tokyo. So it is sitting there on a number of big faults which are pretty much ready to go. There are a huge number of people. Many of the buildings are well constructed and will withstand the earthquake, but there are over a million wooden buildings as well, which burn very, very easily, and which can trigger, again, some of these huge fires that caused problems in the 1920s quake. So it's, you know, it is a big worry, certainly.
You know, I've got a quote here, Bill, from a not always reliable source. I'd like to check it with you. It says, scientists at Tokyo University estimate there is a 98% chance that in the next 30 years, Japan will be hit by an earthquake equivalent to that Great Kanto of 1923. Seismologists at the Japan Meteorological Agency, however, put the odds of this happening at 70%. Does that sound about right to you?
It does, yes. You know, whether you're talking 70 or 90, that is a very, very high percentage in the next couple of decades. And it really illustrates the point that I think along with Istanbul in Turkey, Tokyo is one of the two most threatened cities in terms of a coming big earthquake.
And our financial system sometimes seems like a house of cards. It wouldn't take too much for one of these big cities to go down, even if it was Los Angeles, and then the whole world economy could be damaged.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the global economy ever since 1928 has really not recovered at all, and it's clearly on edge all the time. And one of these big earthquakes, one of these strategic earthquakes in the wrong place could just, as you point out, cause things to collapse like a house of cards. I mean, I get the impression that the stock markets and the currency markets are really just waiting for something to happen before they just fall apart.
And I've also talked with seismologists who are deeply worried about fault lines near nuclear power plants or the many reactors perched on the edge of the sea within tsunami range. Have you looked into that?
It's not an area that I look at in particular, but as a general point, the whole issue with nuclear power is that most power stations are coastally located, and at times of where we're going to see significant rise in sea level, that is not a good place to have these things. And the sea level could easily be 2 meters higher by the end of the century. In addition to that, the oceans are warming, and of course reactors need cooling water, so they suffer if temperatures are much higher, if heat waves happen. Sometimes they have to be closed down, as has happened in the past. So, notwithstanding a specific tsunami threat from earthquakes, just rising sea levels is going to be a big problem for nuclear power plants that are on the coast.
Now, Bill McGuire, if you are advising a government on prioritizing spending, should it be on preparing for catastrophic geologic events, as we've been discussing, or to slash greenhouse gas emissions? What's your take?
I think it has to be climate change. We are in a dreadful situation, despite the Paris conference last December and all the backslapping and all the congratulations. I really don't think that's come up with anything firm whatsoever. Even if all the countries actually do what they say they're going to do in terms of reducing emissions, we've still got, in my opinion, and many other climate scientists, no chance of avoiding catastrophic climate change. So that has to be the priority. It really does. Things like asteroid impacts, things like super eruptions, these are certain to happen again. There's no doubt about that. But they have long return periods, 50,000 years with a super eruption, a 1 kilometer asteroid, maybe 500,000 years. So they will happen. We should be concerned about them. But climate change is here now. It's happening now. We must do something about it. We must take serious action now.
You know, I've lived for years in quake-prone cities like Vancouver and Los Angeles, and I experienced the deadly L.A. quake in 1971. But I have to say, for the average person just trying to pay the bills, is there anything we can do to prepare, or should we just go on about our lives hoping it doesn't happen?
Well, this is what we do, isn't it? This is what most people do, is go on about their lives hoping it won't happen to them or thinking it won't happen to them. It shouldn't really be down to individuals to concern themselves with these massive geological problems, things like super eruptions or asteroid impacts, whatever, because they are very infrequent. Even governments, although they need to pay attention to these, can't devote vast sums of money to trying to cope them. What we need to do is to hope that we'll get warning signs. I mean, no volcano erupts without warning signs. We've spotted most of the big asteroids now, for example, out there. We've got some good monitoring systems in place. So we would hope that we would see these things in time and be able to take measures then. But I don't want everybody to be locking themselves in a bunker with several hundred tins of baked beans or anything like that. And don't lose too much sleep over it, I would say.
What, it's safe for me to come out and not eat beans anymore?
Yes, I think beans is probably the wrong thing to have in a bunker in large quantities. but you know, we can't afford to take this attitude to climate change. Climate change is absolutely critical, and it's the biggest threat to our race. If we burn all the fossil fuels or substantial proportion of fossil fuels, then the average temperature of our planet could be 30 degrees centigrade instead of what it is now, 14. That physiologically, humans cannot exist under those conditions. That would see a mass dieback, a mass extinction of most of our race. And that's the bottom line.
Right. Have you got another book in the works or a TV series planned?
I've been thinking about this for a while, and I've sort of taken a slight change of tack, and I'm now working on a couple of fiction novels, young adult novels, looking at which involve a climate change component. I'm trying my hand at that at the moment. I'm finding it a lot more difficult than writing popular science, I must admit. But at some point, something may come out. You never know.
And listeners can get a free new short story you've written called Incoming, about climate change and mass migration, at your website at billmaguire.co.uk. As we finish up, is there anything else you would like to add?
Being Vancouver there, obviously, you have got a bit of a seismic risk. We have got the Cascadia earthquake and tsunami problem, which is something which will happen at some point in the future. So although talking in general about people and saying, you know, don't worry too much about these things, clearly, if you live in a zone like that, an earthquake zone, you do need to pay attention to what the authorities are telling you about how to prepare for earthquakes and tsunamis. So just keep safe, really.
Okay, we've been talking with British Professor William Maguire. He's the author of books on extreme global threats and has advised the UK government. And if you can only read one Maguire book, I recommend Waking the Giant, How Climate Change Triggers Earthquakes, Tsunamis, and Volcanoes. I'll put links to Bill and his work in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Bill Maguire, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock.
I hope our East Coast North American listeners noticed that ongoing threat from a collapse in the Canary Islands. There have been sea slides before which created massive tsunamis all around the North Atlantic Basin, from the United Kingdom to Canada, America, and right over the Caribbean islands. We really don't have to live on a fault line to be part of Earth's geological pageant. On April 20th, the Seismological Society of America began its 2016 annual meeting in Reno, Nevada. High on their list is the Cascadia Subduction Zone, which runs just off the west coast of North America. It goes from northern Vancouver Island in Canada to southern Oregon in the U.S. There's been enough science to know this pressure point between two massive tectonic plates of the Earth. It moves in a jolt every 400 to 600 years. The last one was in the year 1700. We don't know when the next one will be, but it's due. Aside from the possible wreckage in Vancouver, Seattle, and other coastal cities, the resulting tsunami would sweep clean the coasts of California and Hawaii. It would probably reach Japan, as it did in the year 1700. Let's rock on with our next guest, Dr. Robert Yates.
Radio EcoShock.
You can divide the human population into two kinds of people, those who have experienced a major earthquake and those who have not. Each thinks differently. Robert S. Yates says we don't think about quakes nearly enough. Sooner or later, likely sooner, a mega city somewhere in the world will be hit with something that makes the 9/11 terrorist attack in New York look small. His new book is Earthquake Time Bombs, and he should know. Bob Yates is a professor emeritus in geology from Oregon State University. He's the author of the book Living with Earthquakes in California and co-author of The Geology of Earthquakes. Bob, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so what got you started on earthquakes?
Well, I was working for a consulting firm in Southern California, after an earthquake in 1971, and it destroyed a new hospital. Well, the hospital was 4 months old, and the earthquake happened, and it completely demolished the hospital. And I'm a structural geologist, and I realized that this earthquake happened on a fault, which is what I study. In fact, I'd been working for Shell Oil Company, and we were studying faults because they're possible sources of oil and gas exploration. And I said, this is really what I want to do, rather than writing. I write papers for my colleagues, my professional colleagues, but I feel it's more important with the books you mentioned to write for the general public, for the people in your audience and other similar audiences.
And moving forward, 5 years ago, you were interviewed by Scientific American. You told them Port-au-Prince in Haiti was in jeopardy due to a major fault line and the lack of money to prepare. A week later, 100,000 people died in a catastrophic quake. Was that just chance?
Yes. Port-au-Prince had had an earthquake in the 18th century. Prior to Haiti becoming independent, it was still a possession of France at the time. And the one thing that stood out at the time of the interview was that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Two things, that plus the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are migrating toward the capital, toward Port-au-Prince. And the other thing is that there's a big fault, runs right outside the capital city, and this fault had motion in the 18th century. And so I knew, as a geologist, that this place is going to have an earthquake. However, I didn't know that it was going to happen a week after my interview. That was completely serendipitous, if you will. It went viral because of that fact, but nonetheless, we could not predict that earthquake. And, of course, that's part of our problem. Since we can't predict them here in Oregon, people say, well, okay, there's going to be an earthquake someday, but I got to spend lots of money fixing my house and fixing my school, so I'll just put it off, you know. And that's our problem, trying to convince people that they need to take action, they need to do it now before a lot of people get killed.
Well, now, later I'm going to ask you about the theory that climate change could lead to more earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, but I'd like to leave that for now. Let's look at what we can learn from the deadly earthquake in Kathmandu, Nepal, not the smaller one that hit in February 2016 this year, but the big one in April 2015. Tell us what happened.
Okay, Nepal lies on a plate boundary. It's the boundary between the Indian plate, which is pushing northward from over the past 60 million years, and the Eurasian plate, which is to the north, which is mainly Tibet. And so this place has had some big earthquakes. They had an 8.1 in 1934. Unfortunately, it couldn't be studied by an international group because Nepal was a closed country in 1934. And so the British in India couldn't get up there, and the Nepali people couldn't get down to India. So that really went reported, but it didn't have the analysis that you would get today. And that was part of the problem. People have been saying this is going to have another big earthquake, and I guess the discussion has been, is could there be a bigger one? Could there be an 8.5 or a 9? Right now I'm reviewing a paper in the Nepal area, a scientific paper submitted by a team of Indian seismologists. They're saying that in 1255 AD, which is just only like yesterday to a geologist, the 1255 earthquake had happened in from Kathmandu East, and it was an 8.6. That's a real big earthquake. And then, of course, not so many people live there. But now the place is very heavily populated, and people in some places are well prepared. Most places, though, they are not. And so a lot of people died, but nonetheless, it could have been a lot worse.
Well, aside from the thousands of poor people killed and the hundreds of thousands left homeless, some World Heritage sites were destroyed almost before our eyes where modern buildings stood. What are we supposed to do to preserve the treasured past?
Well, I have a colleague named Brian Tucker. He'd be another good one to have on your show. He's a seismologist. He just visited me last week. He's a seismologist, and the difference is he formed a firm that was a nonprofit called Geohazards International. And so he has devoted his life and that of, and his colleagues to getting people ready to answer that very question as to how do you prepare. And he started out with Nepal. He started out with Kathmandu and formed a group situated in Kathmandu. He trained people to deal with the problem, Nepalese to deal with the problem. And as a result, you would say, well, 9,000 people died. That's a horrible number. But nonetheless, I think it had not been for the people really getting on the ball after about 2001, I think, when this was started. It would have been several times that. It would have been much, much worse. So there are people who are dealing with this, and Nepal is sort of getting there, you know. It could have been a lot worse, this earthquake that happened, or the two earthquakes that happened in April and May. But nonetheless, they've got a long way to go.
Well, as you've pointed out, there has been a rush of people out of the countryside and into urban slums all over the world. And how does that new trend combine with the geology underneath?
Well, I think the migration of people to major cities worldwide, both those in earthquake country and those not in earthquake country, is the largest migration of people in human history. Port-au-Prince was a perfect example of that. The 18th century earthquakes, the loss of life there was probably in the dozens. It was because very few people live there. But now, in fact, they've never really gotten a good agreement on how many people died in that earthquake in 2010. The general consensus is it was almost 200,000 people, but it's sort of hard to get a good number. But it was large. It was large mainly because there were so many people living there. You know, the government is still in terrible condition. They're trying to put another president in office, and there's a lot of stuff going on that I'm not qualified to talk about. But nonetheless, it's a basket case of a country in terms of preparing for earthquakes. In the book that I have written, that the interview with Scientific American got me thinking about this, and I said, you know, I'm a geologist, and I know about plate tectonics, and I know about earthquakes. Is it more important for me to write to other people like myself, or is it more important to write for people like yourself and your audience, and trying to get people to prepare all over the world? And there are places that are in the news for other reasons, like Caracas, Venezuela, for example. And it's one of the time bombs. In 1812, there was an earthquake that killed 10% of the population of that province of Venezuela. But under Chavez's government and under the present government, they've got a lot of other problems that are bothering them, mainly people trying to get the president to resign. And so earthquakes aren't on their list. It's going to have a big earthquake, and the government will be quite unprepared, although there are some scientists there. One of them is a good friend of mine who are leaders in the study of earthquakes throughout South America. But it's just the government, the bureaucracy is just in their way. They can't get anyone to pay attention. And that probably even includes the press, the media. You know, they've got all these political problems after the death of Chavez that they don't have time to think about it. And as I say, my colleagues in Venezuela can't predict when the next earthquake is going to strike, so we put it off, right?
Yeah. You know, I spent 25 years, Bob, in Vancouver, Canada, always being predicted that there will be a big one there. We had bug-out packs by the front door in case the quake came. We were afraid for our kids who went to an old brick school every day. The government always promised to reinforce those schools, but never got around to it. You know, if a couple of bridges fell in Vancouver, that place would be cut off from the outside aid, except by ship or air. How does all that look to you?
Well, in Oregon, we had a study done by a committee which was authorized by the legislature. And it had specialists in seismology and geology and city planning and so forth. Look at just what you're talking about. What are the probabilities and what should we be doing? And they pointed to bridges. In fact, they did a study of every major bridge in Oregon, and they concluded that a lot of these bridges are obsolete they're likely to collapse in an earthquake. And so that was presented to the 2015 session of the legislature, which had authorized this committee. You know what they did with it? Nothing. They didn't do anything. They had a bill, sort of a transportation bill, and they took no action on it. It got involved in politics. So the bridges, including, I live part-time in Newport, Oregon, including a bridge that's just a few miles from my house. That bridge was built in the 30s. It does not meet modern standards. It's likely to collapse, and if it collapses, I'm not going to be able to travel between Corvallis, where I live, and my house at the coast. And not only is the place going to be cut off, it'll mean that the people who are doing business there won't be able to deal with their market. And so that could mean that people leave Newport, not only bridges, but also fiber optic cables. We could be completely cut off. But nonetheless, the legislature, and they just had a short session that just closed earlier this month, never came up. I mean, they've been presented with this study, and the media has sort of covered it, but not enough people like yourself who are trying to spread the word. It's very frustrating, you know. We're doing our thing, and we're trying to tell people about it, but we're trying to get folks to pay attention. You know, there's a lot of unreinforced masonry buildings in Portland, and when one of the city commissioners, a guy named Steve Novick, thought that there ought to be a mandatory retrofit of these old buildings because people are going to die in those buildings, the unreinforced masonry guys got together and they formed an organization called the Brickers. And they said, fine, reinforce the buildings if you like, but you have to pay for it. We're not going to pay for it. This is despite the fact that there are people living and working in those buildings that will die when a building collapses around them. I mean, they're already, some of them are not usable just because they're old. I find that really, really frustrating.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Robert Yates. We're talking about his new book, Earthquake Time Bombs. You know, when I was young, I was in the deadly 1971 earthquake in Los Angeles.
Oh, that's the one that got me started.
Well, there you go. We were both there at the same time, and it was a scary experience.
Well, it was scary to me, too. I lived there.
Yeah, it was 6 in the morning or something. Everyone ran outside in their underwear, in my case. We had to look for teetering palm trees. They have small roots, incidentally, and power poles. But that did seem better than being crushed in the house. But you write that it's a mistake to go outside during a quake. Why is that?
I think in the book, when I write about earthquakes that have happened, say like the 49 Seattle earthquake, there's a natural tendency to run outside. You know, they were just rattling, I was in an earthquake in Mexico City at which this happened. You know, it was glasses were breaking, people were swearing in Spanish and stuff. And so what'd we do? You know, here I am, I'm supposed to know what I'm doing. We ran outside. Well, the problem with running outside is that if the building is unreinforced, and these buildings were kind of clapping together, they were built real close together, you know, what it could have meant is these bricks fall on us and we were killed, would be killed. And the 49 earthquake, there was a big guy there tending bar, and they had the earthquake, and people jumped up and wanted to run outside, and he went to the door, wouldn't let them out. And so all those lives were saved just because this one guy, the bartender, just happened to have the presence of mind of saying, no, it's dangerous out there. And true enough, once they quieted down, they went out, and there's just nothing but bricks piled around the door. They'd all been killed by falling bricks.
And the second lesson for me from that Los Angeles quake is that the first 3 days can be the test of surviving well or not at all. Gas lines blew up, electricity went out. In a worse quake, food deliveries would stop, maybe stores would be looted and empty. And there are frightening aftershocks during all that. Talk to us about surviving after the quake.
Here, this again involves preparation. And I talk about that in one of the books. I have a book called Living with Earthquakes in the Pacific Northwest, which includes you in Vancouver. And this book discusses things like that. It discusses reinforcing your house, what you should do and it sort of addresses all those questions. But yeah, there are ways to, I mean, don't run around looking for damaged places and getting in the way of rescue operations. You know, whether people pay attention to that remains to be seen. But in our case up here, in your case, all of our cases here in the Northwest, we know the earthquake history of the Cascadia subduction zone for the last 10,000 years, because when the earthquake happened, it caused sort of a slump, sliding deposits coming off down the continental slope. And these produced deposits that my colleague and former student, Chris Goldfinger, has actually dated those. And so we got 10,000 years of record. And so based upon that, you can do a probability analysis. Chris has calculated that there's about a 15% chance in the next 50 years that you're going to have a magnitude 9 earthquake, which would include you as well as us. And there's a larger chance, say a 30 or one chance out of three, to have an earthquake of, say, magnitude 8.5. And that sounds like, are you going to get hit by a Jeep or a Mack truck? But nonetheless, there's a big difference in response between an 8.5 and a 9. And so we know that we have this bit of information that we can tell the people up in the Pacific Geoscience Center up in Sydney, near you, are fully aware of that. They're very much involved in the search. There's a guy named Roy Heineman. He's a real good guy, well-spoken. He's written about this, and he's like me, you know. He says, okay, I'm a specialist, but I need to talk to fellow Canadians about what I do. I can't just sit here and just write papers for other people like myself. So Canada's kind of on board. There's a guy in Ottawa named John Adams, who's a New Zealander, and I knew him as a New Zealander first. And John has also been one of the real international leaders.
Well, having lived through an earthquake, I have to tell you, it was one of the most frightening moments of my life, and I found myself a little resistant to talking about them or to you. Is that an after effect, a kind of trauma that's common to people after a quake?
Probably. I know that after I experienced an earthquake in Mexico City in the late 70s, people were killed. You could hear sirens going off. And what do? We ran outside. Did exactly the wrong thing. Here I am supposed to know what I'm doing, but we ran outside. So later on I said, man, was I lucky or what? I mean, it's a completely odd thing to happen. You don't expect it to happen. And indeed, the last big one to happen in Cascadia was in January of 1700 AD, which was before the Lewis and Clark expedition. You know, but geologic time has its own time frame.
Yeah. Now, look, I want to talk about a couple of other places in the world. Right now, Turkey's almost in a civil war. The buildings collapse there from time to time just because of poor building standards. Is there a quake risk in Turkey as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a big time. Turkey, however, Istanbul is a different situation. I've been to Istanbul and worked on it, and I've been to the big fault. There's a fault that runs right offshore from Istanbul called the North Anatolian Fault. And it had a huge magnitude 8 earthquake in 1939 in the very early days of World War II. And you couldn't get there because of the war. But there was a Turkish seismologist and geologist who sent a crew out. They worked on this one and several others that happened still during the war. And he was the first guy in the world to publish the relationship of the earthquake to plate tectonics, even though plate tectonics wasn't even invented, but the idea that the area to the south of Istanbul is going to move with respect to the area within and to the north. So as a result of that, they had a couple of big earthquakes in 1999, and a lot of people died. One of the illustrations in my book is of an aerial shot of an area that was damaged in the 1999 earthquakes. And the interesting thing is that religious buildings, mosques and minarets, they survived just fine. But all the apartment buildings around Istanbul were just big hot piles of rubble, and thousands of people lost their lives. So what that showed me was the Turkish engineers know how to design a proper building, but it's just the corruption is so bad, and people moving to these buildings trying to find work, you know, the big population explosion that was going on in Turkey. they have no political stroke at all. You know, they have nobody looking out for them because they're country people coming in there trying to find work. So as a result, a lot of them were killed. Thousands of them lost their lives in the 299 earthquakes. So after that, there's been another earthquake warning that was issued, three different studies by three different international groups. And so this time, the Turks are taking it much more seriously. I have a colleague at a university in Istanbul called Bogazici, and he has led a campaign, along with others, a lot of it by engineers, for preparedness. They have borrowed over a billion euros to try to make this happening, and they're retrofitting schools and retrofitting hospitals. So Turkey's going to come out better. They actually had an earthquake a few years ago in eastern Turkey, and that sort of got their attention again. And so now they may be one of the big success stories. Now, Tehran, just to the east, equally big city, that's another story entirely. I don't think the mullahs, I think if God wills, they'll have an earthquake and nothing they can do about it. Although there are very fine, very highly qualified earthquake engineers and geologists. I work with a colleague he's an Armenian Christian, so he was a refugee, came to the U.S., but nonetheless, he's the most knowledgeable person about earthquake in Iran. And he and I are publishing a paper. He's also published stuff in Farsi, you know, to try to get people. And he has colleagues that just think he's great, you know. Which I do too. He's one of my heroes. But nonetheless, the government—they're clueless. I don't say they're clueless. They just don't have any interest in this problem. If you can't predict it, inshallah, if God wills, there'll be an earthquake. Not a damn thing we can do about it.
Oh, boy.
So it's really, really sad. And there, I think the book tries to focus on places like that, Caracas in Guayaquil, Ecuador, you know, and Jerusalem is another one. They have had earthquakes, and they're fairly close to a major plate boundary fault called the Dead Sea Fault. And they have had earthquakes that are recorded in the Bible, actually. I think the Israelis, I have to give them some credit here in that the Israelis take the earthquake threat much more seriously than, let's say, the Iranians do.
Now, as the tsunami in Japan showed us and the one in Indonesia that spread across the whole of South Asia, we don't have to be in an earthquake zone to suffer high casualties from a quake in the ocean floor. Did you write about that in this book?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's... in the book, Living with Earthquakes in the Pacific Northwest, which is available online, it's free, available for free online, and it describes the tsunami of 1964 accompanying the Great Alaskan earthquake of that year. And there are people killed in Oregon and more people killed in California, and that tsunami was spread all over the Pacific. Some of the evidence we have from exactly when the last big one, the January 1700 earthquake in Cascadia, the evidence comes from Japan. And the reason is because they recorded that tsunami. They called it an orphan tsunami. And the orphan tsunami didn't have an earthquake associated with it because the earthquake was all the way across the Pacific in our part of the world, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia. And so... that's been a real detective story, and the Japanese, there's a guy named Kenji Sataki, who actually used to teach at the University of Michigan, but he's now with the University of Tokyo, but they have done that, and he's worked with a guy named Brian Atwater, who's with the USGS, and I'm sure you've heard of him. There's actually a book about the orphan tsunami that's been published.
Bob Yates, what do you think about the small quakes happening in Oklahoma as a result of fracking? Could a large-scale quake be triggered by fracking?
I'm not sure, and I think my take on the Oklahoma quakes is that they're related to oil and gas conditions. I don't know, and I'm not going to go out on a limb and suggest, except to say that it's almost certainly related. I mean, formerly, before all of this recent activity, when the price of oil was over $100 a barrel, there was almost no earthquakes in Oklahoma and Kansas and adjacent places. And now there are just huge numbers of them. And my guess is this is related to either fluid injection, what they call fracking, or due to wastewater disposal. You know, a lot of when you produce oil and gas, and I'm going to go back to my Shell Oil Company roots here, that fracking is sort of a standard way that you increase productivity in wells. And it was been huge additions have been made in places like North Dakota, which is a major oil producing state that it was not before. And so the sad thing is that once all this started happening and people started getting upset, it was kind of hard for the state government to take this seriously. Well, we don't know if there's any relation or not. Well, of course there's a relationship. Come on. And so it's a political hazard kind of going on as we speak. But I don't think that the earthquakes, the largest one I know about is a 5.6. I do not believe that those earthquakes are signs of a big earthquake, because the faults in Oklahoma are totally different from those in the Pacific Northwest.
We're starting to run low on time. I just want to squeeze in a couple of other things. I want to talk to you about Dr. Bill McGuire. He works at the University College of London's Hazard Research Center, and he's published a book and articles, one in the Guardian newspaper in 2012, saying that the masses of melting ice from Greenland and Antarctica will destabilize existing faults. He expects more earthquakes and more volcanic eruptions because of climate change. I don't see anything about that in your new book, Earthquake Time Bombs. Why not?
I'm not sure that I buy that story. I have not seen the book. It has not received much press. And I don't want to badmouth this guy, but nonetheless, in terms of earthquake prediction, just because we can't do it, there are a lot of people out there who think they can. And so the book does describe a couple of those. One guy who has a PhD in climatology, actually, and he predicted that we're going to have a big earthquake in New Madrid, Missouri, near St. Louis, between St. Louis and Memphis. And he had some sort of theory about the juxtaposition of planets and so forth. And he sold newsletters to people, interested people. And so he said that he actually predicted a date, time for the earthquake. And of course, the media jumped all over it. Yeah, they sent trucks there, you know, and scared everybody to death. And their time came and went, no earthquake. But that's the problem we have. You know, there are people who, and I do write about that. The book has a chapter about when's the next big one. And that book has discussion about some of these, what I call fake predictions. Another guy predicted a big earthquake in Lima, Peru. And he had a PhD. Well, both these guys had PhDs, so watch people that have PhDs. Some of them are you want to listen to and others you don't. And this guy predicted an earthquake in Lima, Peru. Well, Lima, Peru has lots of earthquakes. And so it nearly caused an international incident. And so one of the directors of the National Earthquake Hazards Program actually went to Lima, appeared in the media and said, I'm here. On the day of the earthquake, I'm here because I don't believe there's going to be one, and there wasn't one, and so it all kind of went away. So that's a totally different problem, getting people to take earthquakes seriously, but not to be dissuaded. I'm not saying this guy at the University of London is in that category. I can only say that I haven't heard a thing about this, but I don't think that the melting ice caps of Greenland, personally, I think those aren't going to produce a huge earthquake.
Okay, now we have to wrap up. What do you hope your new book will do?
The purpose of the book is to get people, Portland, Vancouver, Seattle, all around the world, to take earthquakes seriously. We have a whole bunch of people who are trying to legitimately forecast an earthquake, and we don't use the term prediction. We don't use the P word anymore, but we do use the term forecast. And what we do is we say, what's the probability? That's what I was saying. Chris Goldfinger has done this. Other people have done it. We have one thing that's kind of cool that I'll tell you about, and that is that there's short-term signals that, for example, an earthquake wave in the ground goes slower, much slower, than the electronic signal that's recorded on a seismograph in Pacific Geoscience Center or Seattle or Port Corvallis, Oregon, for that matter. So you have up to a few minutes to stop if surgery going on, operating rooms, Japan has pioneered this, and so they once they get the signal, they shut down the bullet train. I call that predicting an earthquake after it happens, because it's already happened, but the signal hadn't reached you yet, but you still have time. And the Mexicans are perhaps among the best. They're up there with the Japanese because their subduction zone is offshore, but the place that is most greatly at risk is the city of Mexico City, which is built on soft, squishy, jello-like lake clays. And so the damage that was done, it was an earthquake in 1985, and the big damage was done in Mexico City, not on the subduction zone where the earthquake happened. Those are some things that we can do, but we'd like to be able to improve our prediction. And there's kind of a controversy. Some of my colleagues who are seismologists, more knowledgeable than me, think that the Earth is just too complicated to do this.
Well, my personal early warning system is my dog or my cat. When they take off, I get worried.
That's right. Yeah? Yeah, some people rely on their horse, you know.
Okay. We've been speaking with longtime earthquake expert Robert S. Yates. He's a retired professor emeritus with Oregon State University, an expert in the field, author of works on quakes, and now brings out his new warning book, Earthquake Time Bombs. It's not a technical book, although it is stuffed with fascinating facts, but it's a really good read and a primer for all of us. I enjoyed it. I'll put some links to the quakes and ideas we've talked about in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Bob Yates, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. We'll talk to you again.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Will we see a new wave of volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and tsunamis as climate heating melts the ice caps? Even without that, our just-in-time globally linked financial system is not ready for large-scale disasters. Add in the shaky economic times, with unsupportable debt everywhere. Mix in dwindling resources and the hits from extreme weather. It might not take much to darken our future. Meanwhile, where I live in Canada, food prices went up 14% in just 1 month, according to the government. When I talked with our mega hazards expert, Bill McGuire, he'd just come in from planting potatoes in their home in the Highlands. His family moved out of London. I'm heading out tomorrow to plant my own potatoes in our little village plot. I moved out of Vancouver. Coincidence? Maybe.
Radio EcoShock.
I've just got time for a quick bit of climate news. It's been so hot around the world that Gavin Schmidt, head of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, tweets we already know 2016 will again set a new heat record. It's only April, and we know this is going to be another hottest year. This year will likely be about 1.32 degrees C hotter than it was at the end of the 1800s. During the past couple of decades, global mean temperature rose about 0.1 degree per year. This year is expected to be more than twice that. Sure, it's El Nino, but it's El Nino in a rapidly heating world. We don't know if each of these temperature peaks will ever go back down, even a little. The Arctic is so hot, it's practically on fire. Sea ice levels are again the lowest ever recorded for this time of year. Robert Scribler's blog reports, quote, "During the first 3 months of 2016, the Arctic region above 66 degrees north latitude has been fully 4.5 degrees C hotter than the NASA 20th century baseline," end quote from Robert. You know, he was a professional threats analyst for JANES, the information service, and he calls on a series of science reports to estimate this wild Arctic warming could drive a cold snap into the United Kingdom and Northern Europe this coming week. Colder air that should have been in the Arctic gets driven out and along a trough in the jet stream by a series of heat storms hitting Siberia, Alaska, and northern Canada. Meanwhile, in Australia, scientists and their students are literally driven to tears by the latest assessment of coral health in the Great Barrier Reef. Up to 95% of that coral has been bleached due to hotter oceans. Some of it will recover, maybe. We don't know how much. It's a world-class tragedy, and not enough people are paying attention. Those are the nurseries of the ocean and the wonders of the world. And I have to wonder what people in Australia thought would happen after they voted in the climate denial party, got rid of their carbon taxes, and poured on government investments and subsidies into expanding the dirty coal industry. Coal kills the climate, and with it, the systems we depend on. It's as simple as that. I'm Alex Smith. Be sure to follow up with our links to the guests and topics in this week's Radio EcoShock in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
We're lucky enough to be joined by Narvin, who is a refugee who's published a book called From Hell to Hell. How are you going today, Narvin?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks.
Tell us about your... We'll talk about your book, and then we'll talk about your experiences, and then come back
sure.
to the crowdfunding. Narvin is doing crowdfunding to publish the second run of your book?
Yeah.
So tell us about the book.
Yeah, my book is called From Hell to Hell. It's an experience of the detention center. So while we was spending the time in detention center, how we coping with the things we faced, and we forced to use the things from this inhuman politics. So I don't see in my future in the detention center. So I need to express my feelings, and I need to share my feelings with this Australian nation. So English is my third language, and I faced lots of suffering and problem while I was in the detention center. So most of Australians, they don't know what's going on around the detention center. So that's why I'm calling always, that's inhuman dumping, that's human dumping ground, especially Nauru and Manus. So while I was in the detention center, I thought I need to share my express my feelings with Australians, and I couldn't find the way. I'm not a writer before, so I tried to write my experience in my third language, like a poetry and drawings. And I write every day. I started to drawing every day. I'm completely coping my times with my drawings and writing, and all the time. And I sharing on my Facebook, the people saw that and comment me. And I thought, okay, this is the best way to express the feelings and knowing to people. And finally, I decided to, I can publish the book, but I couldn't find the publisher. And one of my friends from Adelaide, his name is Leslie Walker. She just introduced one of the best publisher, Janet Galbraith. She's the Writing Through the Fence administrator. Then she asked me, I would like to publish your poetry and stars. I said, I'm really happy to do that. Then we worked more than 2.5 years while I was in a detention center, because I am more than 3.5 years spent the time with nothing in the detention center. So we decided to publish the book, and we worked more than 2.5 years to get out the book and sharing the book with Australians in my words. And finally, I published that book last year, December 9th. So I recently got out from the detention center. I got visa living in community. My first book launching happened in Melbourne.
Tell us about your trip to Australia, your journey that you went through to come to Australia.
Oh, it's a very hard journey because, you know, always beautiful is very dangerous. So I used to to I offer my life to get best life. That means I offer my life in the sea. We don't know if we're going to be survive or not until we landed in Australian land. I started my journey 2012, 12th of August, and 22 days journey after 2012, September 3rd, we landed on Cocos Island.
So you came from Sri Lanka?
Sri Lanka to, yes, right away, Sri Lanka to Cocos Island, 22 days journey. It's very terrible journey. We have faced lots of suffering in the journey. Last 4 days, we haven't got any water, any food. We drink salty water with some of drinks packet last 4 days. So nearly to die, but we survived last 3 days. Thank God for that. 58 people, we came by boat with my friends and others. And after that, when we reached to Cocos Island, that same day, they transferred to Christmas Island Medical Camp. They did the medical stuff and things. And we had a meeting with immigration. Then they said they have changed the policy 2012, 13th of August. Who come by boat, they're all going to be sent to offshore processing center. That's called Nauru and Manus. So you guys going to be sent there. Then they're going to be started the processing. So you need to wait long time. They didn't mention how long we need to wait in Nauru and Manus. And finally they said, we're going to be processing under the UN law. If you find out real refugee, or you need to wait to get the visa from 21 countries, any of the countries they invite to leaving their country, you need to wait until they invite. At the moment, completely we disappointed, because when we started the journey, we thought Australia is humanitarian country. We're going to get a good life and we're going to have a bright future. When I heard that, I completely disappointed and I'm destroyed at the moment. My hopes and my dreams, everything, take it and throw over. Yeah, I feel that at the moment. I'm so helpless and so alone. Then after 10 days, they transferred to Nauru. The first lot, 2012, 14th of September, we were sent by the government, Australian government at the moment, Julia Glad government. We were sent to Nauru. When we went to Nauru, it's very terrible. It's very, very terrible to living at the moment. It's camp is very uncomfortable condition. Just green tent, no power, bush everywhere, just green tent, small tent, 6 stretchers, no bed or nothing, no fan, no mosquito nets or anything. So we used to live there for like that more than 1 month. After that, they get the power and stuff. 30 people, we used 2 toilets and 2 bathrooms at the moment. It's terrible hot, very terrible hot. At the moment, where they were humanitarian group that's called Salvation Army, the security was Wilson Security. Still, I think that Wilson Security is running the camp and providing security things in Nauru. I couldn't get out from that suffering what I face in Nauru. Still, I'm not in a right track. I couldn't choose what I'm going to do in my future, because I spent more than 3 years in Nauru. So a really very hard situation, very hard time they gave it to us in the life when I get to Australia. Yeah, still I couldn't find the words to describe that. Boy, there's what's up with that? Politics, what's up with that?
4ZZZ 102.1 FM, Aniki Show, just after 25 minutes past 12 o'clock. We're speaking to Navin, who has published a book called From Hell to Hell and is doing the second printing of the book and is seeking crowdfunding for that. We're talking about his experiences on Nauru in Australian detention. You want to talk more about what it's like to be in offshore detention, Navin?
Yes, offshore detention center is like a hell, really human dumping ground, because we don't have any choice. Choice is always the staff and the government. So that's very hard to cope, you know. And we need to, so for example, I need to go somewhere I can't go. I need to get permission to get out from that. Even I couldn't get that. I can't go anywhere. So it's an unmovable situation at the moment. So I couldn't choose anything, even my food. If I need to eat something, so I can't cook. But they provide to eat. We should want to eat. So most of the times, we not much eating. We're not sleeping and thinking always. And thinking about the future, what's going to happen. And because no one knows what's going to be happen in our future when we living in a detention center, especially also processing center. Now at the moment, they have changed the policies and it starts, all the bad things comes to the mind. It's really giving us pressure to unthinkable. We couldn't thinking about our future. So very hard condition, living in a tent, bunk beds. It's a small tent, more than 20, 18 people in the tent, no privacy. So it's very hard to explain to me. It makes me more sad when I'm talking about that. Because I used to live, still my friends living there. So I know that experience and suffering, how much suffering they're facing every day. It's very terrible, hot, especially kids. They don't have to choose anything. So they don't have playing stuff. They're playing with rocks, the kids. It's really very hard thing to explain.
So the title of your book, From Hell to Hell.
Yeah.
That's referring to Sri Lanka, from Sri Lanka to Australia. Is that right?
Yeah, because while I was in my place, I feel I'm living in the hell, because I face lots of suffering and lots of problem there. When I came to Australia, then they sent to Nauru, then they also same like that problems I faced, but I just saw my breath only, but I was dying slowly at the moment. So that's why I called From Hell to Hell.
Now, you're seeking crowdfunding. We're going to talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I'm. My first lot printing all run out at the moment. So I mostly use that, the book money also going to Nauru and my friends. I help them and what they need, and I help their family. So I use that money, all the things for them. And also I use that for my traveling. So launching book Sydney and Brisbane and Melbourne and some other places all around in Australia. So I'm just crowdfunding for printing, more printing, because most of Australians still they're asking me they need the book. Really, that book is very useful to Australians to knowing what the feelings in the detention center, the person who living in the detention center. That's not just my feelings. It's talking about everyone's feeling in the detention center. Really, it's single words are not the letters. It's single letters are my tears and my friend's tears in the book. I include that. So I really want to give the books to these Australians to knowing what's the feeling real feelings of. They can feel, they can imagine the life.
So what's the...
Life in the detention center.
What's the website to go to check out the crowdfunding campaign?
It's not a website, but it's on my Facebook page and some of refugee health group page also. That page is, give me a second, I just...
I think it's the Perth-based Refugee Rights and Action Network?
Yeah, it's in there.
Yeah.
And also, it's in there, yeah.
And we'll I'll publish that on our Facebook page, facebook.com/autonomous action radio Aniki Show Facebook page, and also on the 4ZZZ website, 4ZZZFM.org.au, the Aniki Show.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carl Tokay, staff attorney with the ACLU, who talks about his group's lawsuit against the U.S. Bureau of Prisons for refusing to release documents related to the agency's approval of a CIA torture site in Afghanistan. Arabelle Schoenberg, a member of the student climate change group Fossil Free Yale, who addresses a rally about Yale University's recent announcement that the school would divest $10 million from its fossil fuel holdings. And Sonali Kalhatkar, host of KPFK Radio's Rising Up with Sonali program, who discusses the emergence of France's Up All Night movement, where students and workers have launched protests challenging the economic status quo. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the second time in a week, Macedonian police fired tear gas at a crowd of migrants in a resettlement camp in Idomeni, Greece. Since the European Union and Turkey signed a migration agreement on March 20th, over 50,000 migrants have been stranded in Greece, awaiting their asylum applications to be processed, while Greece's neighbors have shut their borders to migrants. To prevent further border clashes, the Greek army staged surprise military exercises along the border with Macedonia. Over 300 people were hurt during the first major clash with migrants along the Macedonian border on April 10th, after Macedonian border guards refused to open a gate to let migrants through. After the border incident, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras condemned the use of force. A Greek spokesman blasted the Macedonians' indiscriminate use of chemicals, rubber bullets, and stun grenades against vulnerable populations. After a second confrontation, Greek authorities arrested 14 European activists for encouraging immigrants to rush the fence. In the midst of the violence, Greece's far-right anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim party, Golden Dawn, has mobilized in cities where migrants have gathered. The Guardian newspaper reports that Chicago Police Department internal documents reveal that officers used physical force against 14 men in custody at a secret interrogation center known as Holman Square. According to the documents, police used punches, knee and elbow strikes, slaps, wrist twists, baton blows, and tasers against detainees at Holman Square, and The Guardian has identified two deaths of suspects that occurred there. The injured men were among over 7,300 people, more than 6,000 of them African Americans, who police documents show were detained and interrogated at Holman Square without public notice of their whereabouts or access to an attorney. The Chicago Police Department is now under federal investigation for suppressing a video recording of the October 2014 police shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. According to a report released April 13th by a task force appointed by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, department data gives validity to the widely held belief the police have no regard for the sanctity of life when it comes to people of color. The task force looked at more than 400 shootings in Chicago from 2008 to 2015 and found that about three-quarters of the people wounded or killed in police shootings were African American, though blacks make up only a third of the city's diverse population. Hispanics accounted for 14%, while whites made up only 8% of those shot. Since 2004, the city of Chicago has paid out over $600,000 in settlements for police abuse. High-profile incidents of domestic terrorism in places like Charleston, South Carolina, and Colorado Springs, Colorado, point to the rise of extremist and white separatist groups across the United States. In 2015, the Southern Poverty Law Center identified a 14% increase in the number of hate groups, even as activity declined among neo-Nazis and racist skinheads. Chapters of the Ku Klux Klan saw a big surge with the high-profile debate triggered by the movement to take down the Confederate battle flag from the grounds of the South Carolina Capitol and across the South. Rallies in support of the Confederate flag were held in 26 mostly Southern states. At the same time, so-called patriot groups expanded, espousing anti-government views and conspiracy theories. Mark Potok, a senior fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center, told the Christian Science Monitor, "There's a lot of anger among the white working class and to some extent the middle class." But, he adds, "In a society that's grown increasingly diverse, we as citizens need to work at building bridges. We've got a tough road ahead," says Potok, "but I don't have much doubt that after this long, very dark tunnel, we as a country will come out in a better place." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Since the public first learned about the Bush administration's approval of torture techniques used by the CIA and military personnel against suspected terrorists held by the U.S. at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba and other covert sites around the world, there have been a number of unsuccessful attempts to hold government officials accountable for their violation of international and U.S. law. On April 14th, the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the Federal Bureau of Prisons for their refusal to turn over requested documents under the Freedom of Information Act. The document sought by the Civil Liberties Group relates to a 2002 visit by Bureau of Prisons officials to a CIA secret detention site in Afghanistan, codenamed Cobalt, also known as the Salt Pit, where the Bureau's staff reportedly gave a positive assessment of the conditions there and offered training to the site's administrators. This despite documented evidence in the Senate Intelligence Committee's torture report that detainees held at this site were subjected to torture, solitary confinement, and sensory deprivation conditions, which led to at least one known death of a prisoner held there. Your reporter spoke with Carl Tokay, staff attorney with the ACLU's National Prison Project, who talks about why his group launched the lawsuit against the U.S. Bureau of Prisons and the larger issue of U.S. personnel and their superiors not being held accountable for their violation of international treaties and U.S. laws that prohibit the torture of prisoners.
So the first revelations about the Bureau of Prisons being involved in the CIA torture sites came out when the executive summary of the Senate torture report was released in December 2014. And we went through and realized, wait a minute, what is the Federal Bureau of Prisons doing at a CIA torture site? This is an agency that is responsible for running the federal prison system. They provide technical assistance to state prison officials around the country. And it was surprising to see them involved in visiting these black sites run by the CIA. What was especially surprising, though, was that the report indicated that they went to a particular torture site in Afghanistan that's codenamed Cobalt in the report. Many people know it as the Salt Pit. And they looked at the conditions there, where people were locked up indefinitely in solitary confinement, in total darkness, shackled to the wall with only a bucket to use as a toilet, and said, "We think this is not inhumane," and gave it a thumbs up, and allowed the CIA to continue doing what it was doing. And that's profoundly disturbing for a number of reasons. So we filed a Freedom of Information Act request for all of the documents regarding the Bureau's visit to the CIA black site and all of the advice that they gave to the CIA afterwards, and they stonewalled us. They said, we have no responsive documents. We did an administrative appeal where they responded the same way, and that's why we're now filing this lawsuit.
Carl, from the Senate torture report, what else do we know about this particular detention center that the CIA was running? I know that the torture report cited some instances where detainees lost their lives or were severely injured in the abuse of prisoners there by U.S. personnel. What do we know about this particular site, as you said, codenamed Cobalt or the Salt Pit?
Actually, on the very day that the Bureau of Prisons sent its inspection team to the Salt Pit, a detainee named Gul Rahman died. One of the interrogators had ordered that he be stripped of all of his clothing except for a sweatshirt. So he was mostly naked on the floor of his cell, chained to the wall in darkness, in temperatures cold enough that overnight he died of suspected hypothermia. And if you can just imagine the setting, some CIA officials called this place a dungeon. Another CIA official said that the baseline conditions of confinement were so extreme that it self-operated as a quote-unquote enhanced interrogation technique.
Carl, maybe you can discuss for us the larger issues of accountability here for torture undertaken by U.S. personnel in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks under the Bush administration. We know that higher-ups in the White House approved these torture techniques. They called it, by a euphemism, enhanced interrogation, I think was the term they used. How does this case figure in, from your point of view, with the utter lack of accountability for military and political leaders during those years when torture was officially sanctioned by the White House?
Well, it's part of the larger pattern of impunity for the officials who approved torture by the CIA. But I think another aspect of this is it shows how the culture of torture crossed over back and forth between the domestic prison system and all of these torture sites abroad. One of the things that many people don't realize is that, for example, Charles Grainier, who was the ringleader of the Abu Ghraib scandal in Iraq, worked as a prison guard in Pennsylvania before he was in the Army Reserves. The prison where he worked was filled with accusations that guards there engaged in brutal abuse, beating prisoners, spitting in their food, using racial epithets, and in one case, beating a prisoner and using his blood to write the letters KKK. That is the environment that Grainier came out of and then brought to Iraq. So all of this is connected. The toleration of abuse and torture in domestic prisons helps normalize it in all of the torture that the CIA engaged in abroad. The accountability is lacking, and it's something that remains important to address now in the future. At some point, we need to reckon with this history of torture, because otherwise, there is no way to stop it in the future.
That was Carl Tokay, staff attorney with the ACLU's National Prison Project. Learn more about the ACLU's lawsuit in efforts to hold government officials accountable for the torture of U.S.-held prisoners by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. the second week of April saw a major escalation of climate activists on college campuses across the U.S., demanding their universities divest from fossil fuel holdings. At Yale University, a push for divestment coincided with a global colloquium of university presidents, which featured an address by United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, speaking on the issue of preserving cultural heritage. The April 12th speech was attended by 30 university presidents from all over the world, including several from the U.S. An hour before the event, Yale announced that it had divested $10 million in coal and tar sands investments out of its $25.6 billion endowment. Yale's chief investment officer, David Svensson, said the rationale for the change was in part due to a determination that such investments are unlikely to be profitable if carbon pricing is ever implemented in the future. Carbon pricing is designed to reflect the true destructive cost to the climate and the environment of burning fossil fuels. Svensson said Yale's endowment portfolio now includes only minor investments in coal and oil. Immediately following the UN Secretary's keynote address, where he briefly spoke about his support for Yale climate activists' call for all universities to fully divest from fossil fuels, 120 students and community members attended a rally organized by the group Fossil Free Yale and the Association of Native Americans at Yale. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the rally and recorded first-year student and Fossil Free Yale activist Arabelle Schoenberg as she spoke to those gathered about Yale's divestment announcement.
It's been kind of a whirlwind day for all of us. We're outside right now, the Global Colloquium of University Presidents. So presidents from Yale, Brown, Columbia, Princeton, NYU, and Penn are hosting Ban Ki-moon, the United Nations Secretary General, for the keynote address for this colloquium. So they're inside Sprague Hall right now. They are uniting under the theme of, quote-unquote, preserving cultural heritage, challenges, and strategies. So Fossil Free heard about this, and we were like, man, that sounds very hypocritical. How can these presidents claim to value cultural diversity and cultural legacy without even engaging in a conversation concerning the literal destruction of communities and victims of the extractive fossil fuel industry? So Ban Ki-moon just delivered the keynote address, and we had a bunch of members of Fossil Free inside the room with him. So he spoke on climate change. He spoke on climate justice. So Ban Ki-moon has spoken directly against the power of the influence of fossil fuel companies and the harm they inflict on predominantly low-income, indigenous, and communities of color. He has urged companies to, quote, reduce their investments in coal and in a fossil fuel-based economy, and he believes that saving our planet, lifting people out of poverty, and advancing economic growth, these are one and the same fight. So Fossil Free Yale really believes that it is important to note that climate change is much more than just an environmental issue. It's also deeply, deeply human and personal. So earlier this afternoon, in preparation for this event, we received news 1 hour prior to the beginning of our action that Yale has decided to remove $10 million of our endowment from a few fossil fuel companies. So this is a huge victory, right? Yale has used this, unfortunately, not as a chance to expose the social harm or stigmatize these powerful companies, but as an economic tactic, saying that it makes financial sense because in the future, coal and oil will no longer be economically profitable. Yale has framed this choice as a confirmation of Salovey's sustainability initiatives rather than acknowledging the work of groups like Fossil Free Yale and ANE, who intend to frame divestment as a tactic for the stigmatization of the companies that harm so many people. Given the lack of information we have been given, it seems apparent that Yale has made a deliberate attempt to kind of mess with this action today, and we don't really think this timing is coincidental. But it is also important to recognize that Yale has heard us, and Yale's scared. So it was hard for me at first when we got this information to realize and to begin to understand that the university really is acting secretly. The university is acting behind closed doors and kind of intending to mess with and like sabotage the work of these student groups who have been working so hard to create this event. But all of that aside, it's also really important to recognize this recent change as a huge victory for divestment, especially at Yale. Regardless of intent, Yale's corporation members are starting to talk about climate change and to change their behavior. This victory is small, and there's still a lot of work to do, and it's really important that we do continue to keep fighting for what we believe in, and that we don't rest until we start to see concrete change here at Yale and also around the world. So this victory comes at a really meaningful time in conjunction with other divestment campaigns across the country. So today, students at UMass Amherst are, like, currently at this second engaged in a sit-in. So they have 100 people who are sitting in, and we've had word of a potential 50 arrests of students at UMass Amherst. And then we also have had word from Harvard, where 4 people have already been arrested for their action as well. So basically, we just want to talk about this in the context of the greater divestment movement across the country. And really, like, universities and people in power are really starting to see us. And not only are they starting to hear us, but they're also starting to listen. And Yale's statement today demonstrates that they're starting to respond to student activists on campus. And this partial victory is an important first step, although it does not reflect an ethics-based university-wide commitment to divestment. Hopefully it represents a change in the consciousness of these universities and really a step towards what we've been fighting for all along. So thank you guys all for coming.
That was climate activist Arabelle Schoenberg of the student group Fossil Free Yale. Find more information on the movement calling for the divestment of fossil fuels at U.S. colleges and universities by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The nation of France has a rich tradition of activism, where in the name of social solidarity, many citizens feel obligated to take a stand on social justice issues, from opposition to war to human rights and labor strikes. It was in that tradition that thousands of students, trade unionists, and progressive activists launched spirited protests across France on March 31st in opposition to socialist president François Hollande's proposal to weaken the country's protective labor laws that unions assert favor business at the expense of workers. But the protests have transformed into a new movement across France and beyond, known as Nuit Debout, or Up All Night. Each evening since March 31st, activists have gathered at Paris's Place de la République to debate and protest against a diverse list of grievances, from immigrant rights to economic inequality and youth unemployment, which now stands at 24%. Although there have been clashes with police and some violence, the movement appears to continue to gather momentum and has now spread to Belgium, Germany, and Spain. Up All Night, which has attracted thousands of supporters, has been compared by many to the U.S. Occupy Wall Street movement, the Indignados uprising in Spain, and even Paris's own student worker protests and strikes, which paralyzed France in May 1968. Your reporter spoke with author and columnist Sonali Kahatkar, host and creator of KPFK Radio's Rising Up with Sonali program in Los Angeles. Here she discusses France's Up All Night movement and its challenge to the nation's economic status quo.
Well, I went to France for the first time last December for the COP21 protests, and France is an amazing country. People are very politically active. They're very politically aware. It's a society conscious, particularly of their labor rights. You know, people have worked very hard over the years to preserve strong labor rights. It's routine in Paris for the entire city to shut down and go on a general strike because, you know, there's some union that's upset about some attack on it. So basically what's happened is that the French president, socialist president François Hollande, you would imagine that as a socialist president, he would be more friendly to workers' rights. But he's been basically unrolling a neoliberal agenda in France and little by little chipping away at the rights of workers. And so he just unveiled labor reform that he has proposed that would essentially make it easier for employers to fire workers. It's very difficult in France to fire somebody, whether you're in a union or not, and most people are. And he basically said that, you know, this would make it easier to hire people. So it would actually be really good for the economy and for workers, but workers weren't buying it. People were very upset. And what happened was on March 31st, a number of people gathered in the Place de la République, which is a very symbolic place in Paris. It has a national monument. It became a site of mourning of the victims of the Charlie Hebdo attacks last January and the victims of the November 13th terrorist attacks. So people gathered there to watch a film called Merci Patron, which essentially means thanks, boss. And it's a film about ordinary French people being threatened by a corporation and being screwed over by a corporation. And apparently what happened on the night of March 31st was that film riled people up so much. They were so angry about the proposed labor reforms, and the film kind of inspired them to do more. And they decided to stay in the Place de la République all night. And thus was born the so-called Nuit Debout, or Up All Night, or Rise Up at Night movement. So people stayed in the Place de la République. It got bigger and bigger. More people came. They stayed overnight. They had Occupy Wall Street-style General Assembly meetings and continue to have them. And they basically decided, we're going to draw the line here in the sand against these reforms. But also, this is sort of a broader, you know, kind of just say no to austerity programs, to pro-corporate, anti-worker programs. And they have been there since March 31st.
Sonali, what is the unifying cry here in terms of the organizing going on in France and across borders in Europe? Is it anti-austerity, or is it something larger than just fighting back against policies in France and these other countries that are asking more from workers in terms of givebacks and such?
You know, my understanding is that essentially this is about strengthening democracy. People are angry that, you know, things that are popular, policies that are popular, are not being pushed by the government. People are angry that their elected representatives continue to kowtow to corporate forces. Of course, here in the United States, we're very familiar. This is a longstanding tradition in our political landscape. But in France, it's becoming worse and worse, and they're not as used to it as we are, and they're understandably and justifiably very angry. And so the broader aspect of this is strengthening democracy. The narrow issue is the opposition to the proposed labor reforms, but by and large now this is becoming a sort of pro-democracy movement. How do we strengthen democracy? How do we revive our democracy? How do we wrench it away from corporate control and back into the hands of ordinary people? And so people are having discussions. Now, of course, the downside of these large, spontaneous mass uprisings or gatherings is that they are often leaderless. And often they may be a little inarticulate because, of course, the nature of these gatherings is that no single voice rises above all else. There's a lot of back and forthing, a lot of group discussions, mass group discussions. And so you can take one impression away from it, which is what the mass media usually does, which is that these groups don't know what they want. You know, we heard this criticism of Occupy Wall Street. They didn't have clear demands. And that's true of Nuit Debout as well in Paris. But the upside of that is that people are getting this feeling, just like Americans did during Occupy Wall Street, that they have the power to take back democracy, that if they physically occupy a space, it makes them feel empowered and gives them the confidence to demand even more. Interestingly enough, the former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, recently visited the Nuit Debout, the heart of the Nuit Debout protests in Paris. In France, the epicenter is the Place de la République, and he was the anti-austerity hero of Greece last year. And when he was finance minister with the Syriza party, the left-leaning anti-austerity party, he's just written a new book. And he, you know, he felt it was important enough to go to Paris and be at this gathering because he also understands that this, in a way, is an affirmation of democracy and a rejection of austerity and essentially pro-corporate policies.
That was author and columnist Sonali Kalhatkar, host and creator of KPFK Radio's Rising Up with Sonali program. Find a link to Sonali's recent TruthDig.com article titled 2 weeks into a major uprising, French activists still staying up all night, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis
of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Is there a bomb in Gilead? The great black activist and artist, Paul Robeson, in 1958 in Carnegie Hall, sang the gospel song Bomb in Gilead. There is a bomb in Gilead to make the wounded whole. His full, magnificent baritone filled the hall with wonder. His words in song sprung back from over half a century when the news emerged of a big, wealthy pharmaceutical, Gilead Sciences Incorporated, buying the drug sofosbuvir, and then tripling its proffered price to treat hundreds of thousands of people suffering from hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a liver infection which can, untreated, lead to immense suffering and death. Sofosbuvir, sold under the names Harvoni and Sovaldi, is more than a treatment. It is a cure, with healing rates over 95%. And it now goes for $1,000, a pill, a full course of treatment, over $100,000. Is there a bomb in Gilead? Yep, there is, but only a few can afford it. To quote Paul Robeson, in the words of this cherished Negro spiritual, there is a bomb in Gilead to make the wounded whole. But if you can't afford it, you die. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
saw. He was a star in so many ways that the word star seems too small. He was a singer, guitarist, band leader, writer, and, well, genius. Prince Rogers Nelson was known and adored by millions who knew him by one name, Prince. He was a superstar, and he was a mystery, both major musical performer as well as a man of privacy. In the now classic film, Purple Rain, Prince's life seeps through in biographical bits. In his 1982 hit, 1999, the lyrics seem almost mystical. I was dreaming when I wrote this, forgive me if it goes astray. But when I woke up this morning, I could have sworn it was Judgment Day. In his own way, he used his voice to reach into the stew of life and pull forth gems, like his comments about the fires in Baltimore and the tragic death of Freddie Gray at the hands of police. He entered the world of music like a stick of sexual dynamite. As he aged, a spiritual side seemed to emerge. Through it all, the genius of the man shined through. He was born named Prince, yes. But at 57 years young, he became a prince of the heart. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Sight and sound of Hillary Rodham Clinton speaking to black folks in Harlem was a reminder of why politics and politicians are so repellent. Promises, promises. Coming from a Clinton, the architects of the greatest imprisonment boom in American history, which wrought immeasurable misery to millions of black folks for decades, such promises come with a bitter cup of betrayal. For blacks, the most loyal constituency of the Democratic Party, one wonders how much is too much. 1 million more prisoners? 1,000 more Sandra Blands? A bit more of the Mike Brown tragedies? The architects of mass incarceration promised to solve a problem they created, right? Hillary Clinton, speaking to the grandmothers of the children she sneered at, no, snarled at, and damned as super predators. Imagine that. The Democratic Party, the former sponsors of the Ku Klux Klan, now want to turn a new face to black millions who wallow in pain. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Golden lies in golden skirts are still lies in Harlem. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
a poisonous tree. In legal theory, there is something known as the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, which holds that an illegal search, arrest, or interrogation poisons or taints all that follows, and as such, it may not be used in a prosecution. If that is so, what if America's failed and corrupt so-called drug war as poisoned a fruit as possible, born as it was, from political lies meant to cover state attacks on radicals, especially black radicals? The recent revelations of former Nixon White House aide John Ehrlichman that drugs were used as a proxy to target blacks and hippies should poison all that sprouted from that foul and loathsome plant. The dirtiest of Dick Nixon's dirty tricks. It has led to the explosion of prisons in American life and the subsequent crippling of millions of families for half a century. The so-called drug war is thus a lie, built on a lie, and used by the state to repress, harass, disrupt, and destroy. Yesterday, the prison ran a dog line, where a pooch ran down a line of prisoners waiting to go to yard. It was as ridiculous as it was revealing. For if there are drugs in prison, it's more likely than not that a staff member brought it in rather than a prisoner. No dog lines for staff, though, huh? The false drug war has, like all wars, been far more destructive than it has been creative, and it has corrupted and poisoned all that has been touched by it. It has corrupted cops who have profited from it as well as become drug merchants. It has reduced the Fourth Amendment to shreds, even as it has intellectually corrupted courts, which ignore the Constitution to further a false war on drugs. It has placed black and Latino youth under lifelong suspicion, subjecting them to arbitrary and oppressive searches, seizures, and arrests. It has fueled the boom in the prison industry. A false war, yes, but which has had real life and death effects. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Is the contemporary climate movement truly forcing the hand of governments to change their behavior in a fundamental way, or is it serving a more insidious agenda? What evidence is there that elite players like the Rockefellers, Bill Gates, and the Clintons are manipulating 350.org and other prominent environmental organizations? How does the fossil fuel divestment movement actually enhance the economic systems destroying the planet? What evidence is there that environmental NGOs have undermined indigenous and racially marginalized peoples around the world? Are there indications that environmental leaders themselves are distorting the science around climate change? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of Earth Day, we have a frank and candid conversation about the current ecological crisis and the inconvenient truths about prominent environmental organizations, false climate solutions, and the dire situation facing humanity. Our guest for the whole hour is investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist Corey Morningstar. On this week's program, the non-profit industrial complex and the co-opting of the environmental movement. A conversation with Corey Morningstar. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of the April 22nd, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Washington may have one last joker up its sleeve, reintroducing the gold standard, the very gold standard that Nixon abandoned in 1971. A new U.S. dollar gold standard would most likely be set at a ratio that would wipe out all U.S. debt, including future unmet obligations, as measured by the GAO, or General Accounting Office, of about $125 trillion U.S. To counter the buildup of this criminal last-ditch sham by the Western Zionist banking czars, China and Russia have been preparing over the last few years an independent financial system delinked from the U.S. dollar and which now incorporates the BRICS, the SCO nations, as well as the Eurasian Economic Union. This association of countries and economies account for about half the world's population and at least one-third of the globe's economic output, a fact totally ignored by the mainstream media for obvious reasons. The Machiavellian sinking ship does not want its passengers to jump to safety. That comes from the article, "The Collapse of the Western Fiat Monetary System May Have Begun, China, Russia, and the Reemergence of Gold-Backed Currencies," by Peter Koenig. Posted April 21st. DHBE released both the Moscow 2011 video of the bomb attack at 9:07 a.m. instead of the Brussels airport CCTV footage, as well as the still image allegedly from the same CCTV airport source in the departure terminal of the three terrorists at 10:25 a.m. If DHBE had been in possession of the real surveillance video footage at 9:07 a.m., why on earth would they have released the Moscow airport footage and then 1.5 hours later come up with an allegedly authentic image from the CCTV airport cameras? While police and surveillance authorities would be able to view and analyze almost immediately the camera footage of the bomb explosion, the same does not apply to the process of identifying three passengers with trolleys mingling amongst several hundred airline passengers also with trolleys in the departure terminal. In other words, to identify three individuals from a large number of airport CCTV cameras with hundreds of passengers traveling early morning would not have been an easy fast-track undertaking. The still images pertaining to hundreds of passengers would have had to be examined, compared to police photographic records, etc. An almost impossible task to achieve in a matter of 2 hours after the blast, assuming that Dernière Heure had access to the CCTV surveillance video data. That comes from the article, The Brussels Terror Attacks, Fake Videos and Images, The Man in the Hat, by Professor Michel Chasidovsky, posted April 20th. Possible future strategic uses of a PLAN carrier battle group include deployment in the South China Sea to effectively increase Chinese area control access denial capabilities, potential regional adversaries such as Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Philippines would have to alter their strategic calculus to account for the added threat of a Chinese carrier battle group in the region when considering any future warfare scenarios. The armed forces of Taiwan have taken notice of the threat and conducted war games recently that involved the addition of a PLAN CBG in a hypothetical invasion of the island nation. It is most likely that the first three aircraft carriers are just a developmental stepping stone to a much more flexible, capable, and powerful class of aircraft carrier. If it is one thing that the PLAN has shown in recent decades, it is committed and capable of developing and fielding modern, complex warships and weapon systems in its quest to stand on a level playing field with any potential adversary, chief amongst them, the United States. That comes from the article, Video, China's New Aircraft Carrier Force Challenges U.S. Naval Hegemony, by South Front, posted April 20th. President Barack Obama has said the classified pages of the 9/11 Commission report that do not compromise major national security interests may hopefully be soon released, but argued against any potential legal action against Saudi citizens. Obama, who flew to Saudi Arabia on Tuesday, discussed in an interview with Charlie Rose his relationship with the Saudi regime and the controversially classified 28 pages of the report, which some believe contain links between 9/11 terrorists or Al-Qaeda and Saudi officials. When asked by Rose if he had read the pages, Obama said he, quote, had a sense of what's in there, unquote. Rose also asked about legislation that would allow relatives of 9/11 victims to sue the Saudis, which passed the Senate Judiciary Committee in January, but has yet to be voted on by the full body. Obama has said that he doesn't support the bill due to the possibility of foreign citizens, presumably victims of U.S. wars and drone strikes, suing the government. That comes from the article, Obama, if we let Americans sue Saudis for 9/11, foreigners will begin suing U.S. nonstop, posted April 20th, originally appearing on RT. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Friday, April 22nd, when this episode first goes to air, marks Earth Day. It's a time when ecologically conscious community members attempt to reflect on their impacts on the natural world and make efforts to reduce those impacts. Listeners to this program may remember conversations with guest Dr. Guy McPherson, who describes the climate crisis as a predicament and not a problem. Problems have solutions, predicaments don't. But it is the nature of modern humans to expect solutions. If we just roll up our sleeves and apply the right amount of resources, particularly financial resources, to address the situation. Worse, those of us living in privilege in major Western centers are seeking out easy solutions and expect to find them. This makes us vulnerable to the messaging of non-governmental environmental organizations, all too eager to assuage our consciences while keeping us all in our physical comfort zones. That is, we can save the world and make money doing it. Enter the environmental non-governmental organizations. Prominent players like the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, and most prominently these days 350.org have been the major powers behind a burgeoning climate movement, which we are told is forcing the hands of economic and political power brokers as we shift political and economic priorities toward taking the necessary steps freeing us from the destructive fossil fuel economy. Our featured guest today has a lot to say on the topic of climate change and the inconvenient truths lurking behind the shadows of these NGOs. In fact, she's written extensively on what she calls the non-profit industrial complex, and for all the talk of system change is actually enabling a system that will only exacerbate the ecological crisis. Her name is Corey Morningstar. Corey Morningstar is an independent investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist focusing on global ecological collapse and political analysis of the non-profit industrial complex. She resides in London, Ontario, Canada. She has contributed articles to Counterpunch, as well as Wrong Kind of Green, The Art of Annihilation.com, and others. She's been making frequent appearances on the Nature Bat's Last radio program on the Progressive Radio Network and is now making her debut on the Global Research News Hour. So, welcome, Corey Morningstar.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Okay, I thought I would start the program because you're such a... I find your writing very... I respect the clarity and the provocative nature of your writing, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to just open our conversation with a quote from your repertoire. So if you might want to...
Sure. And I just wanted to say that your intro was amazing.
Thank you.
It was really good. Okay, I'm going to open up the show with an excerpt from part two of the expose, The 2 Degree Death Dance, the 1% cover... the 1 degree... What did I even say? The 2 Degree Death Dance, the 1 degree cover-up, which was written back in... 2010, I believe, and I think it's good paragraph to open up, considering Earth Day is tomorrow. Okay, so here goes. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. The art of propaganda has been nothing less than brilliant. The deceit is so thick you need a knife to cut through it. The corruption and greed so deep you need wings to stay above it and thigh-high boots to wade through it. An alluring tapestry of luminous lies interwoven with finely textured deception and silk-like corruption, as smooth and seductive as freshly churned butter. The pursuit of man's mind by way of domination has been the greatest and most successful experiment. The manipulation of man's mind has resulted in a massive erosion of empathy, which has allowed status quo, business as usual, to continue uninterrupted with little resistance. Capitalism effectively bred a contempt for our Earth that multiplied like a virus. The pollution of mind mutated into narcissism with inflicted self-hatred to form a suicidal Molotov cocktail. Those who have succumbed now hold hands in a circle and taunt the very planet that gives us life. The ugly side of humanity continues to violently pierce our Earth Mother with drills and slash her beautiful skin with razors. She is losing breath. She is dying. Yet when she lashes back, it will be with an Armageddon death blow against which our own actions will resemble childish prattle. And perhaps not until this time will global society finally recognize that our shared purpose was not to compete with one another and claim dominance and superiority over Earth Mother, but rather our role was to protect, defend, and nurture. The human family, under the arm of its Euro-American Big Brother, will have finally succeeded in conquering our shared planet, only to find that we have destroyed ourselves. End.
Well, thank you for reading that for us. And yeah, you're definitely talking about. I mean, the level, you start off talking about these levels of
deceit, propaganda, and there's a sense of us being misled. And at the same time, we do hear people, I'm talking about regular people who look at the messaging around the climate change and ecological collapse, and many of them wishing to do what they can. But I feel that there's an earnestness there, but it seems like there's not only the deceit coming from these external players, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but also a level of denial that we want to continue living our lives in a certain fashion, and we want to have these sorts of easy solutions. As our mutual friend would say, nature does bat last. Could you speak to that point about, like, first of all, just that how being our own enemies, that we, for all of, what we may look at intellectually, that we're not really willing to do the things that need to be done.
Yeah, that's such a big question. The simplest things, the whole, quote-unquote green movement has become all about consumption, green consumption. And when we look at solutions, it's not about how do we radically alter our Western lifestyle and our, wild consumption habits, and how do we separate what we need from what we want? How do we separate those two things? How do we live with as little, taking as little as we possibly can take? It's all about consuming more, under this guise of green, sustainable consumption. And it's, a very convenient lie to continue living the way we are, to continue exploiting our brothers and sisters across the planet, that all these, that this lifestyle completely and the system completely depends on exploiting and at an accelerated pace. And we do know these things. These aren't this exploitation of our brothers and sisters and our planet is nothing new, but we conveniently, pretend, I sort of call it an agreed-upon alibi. We pretend we can do these things in a kind, gentle manner to continue, this lifestyle, which now has resulted in lifestyle wars, resource wars, for what's left. And there's no talk, coming out of NGOs, which are all part and parcel of the nonprofit industrial complex, coming from government on, how do we contract this economy? How do we do with less? Like how all you hear is, we want more, we want more. Now we want windmills, we want solar, we want electric cars, we want, we want, we want. And the more we produce, the more we destroy, the more we exploit. There's no way around it.
Mm.
So I think there's a lot of convenient denialism happening.
One of the leaders of the climate movement is the celebrated journalist, author, and activist Naomi Klein, who is also a board member of 350.org. Here's a clip from a recent talk held in Winnipeg before an audience of over 1,000 people.
I think Kevin Anderson puts it very well. He was deputy director of the Tyndall Center. He says we have to differentiate between going more slowly down the wrong road and getting on the right road. They are not the same thing. And I think that's part of hype around green tech is that green tech can maybe make us go a little more slowly down the wrong road, but it is not going to help us veer. In order to veer, and that's what we really need to do, we need policy, and we aren't going to get that policy unless we organize. So we can't leave this to our elites, you know, you mentioned that, I mean, there is a awareness, right? I mean, one of the, I have a chapter in the book called The Billionaires Won't Save Us, about how you can have a figure like Michael Bloomberg who knows a whole lot about climate change, gives great speeches about it, you know, funds a lot of green groups through his foundation, publishes reports about how climate change is a huge risk to the U.S. economy, but yet, with his $33 billion worth of wealth, he invested in a specially created fund, a fund that specializes in oil and gas, because we have a structural problem that, at the same time as you can understand the medium to long-term climate risks, you're still going to be drawn to the short-term rewards of investing in the problem. And we've got lots of examples of that.
I asked Corey Morningstar to comment on the apparent contradictions between Ms. Klein's recent messaging about altering a predatory capitalist system and the way environmental NGOs appear to reinforce and protect a plutocratic status quo.
You know, it says right in the jacket of the book that the really inconvenient truth is that it's not about carbon, it's about capitalism. And the convenient truth is that we can seize the existential crisis to transform our failed system and build something radically better. So there's, yeah, we, you know, capitalism is the problem, but we got a solution.
Well, that, and that's the funny thing. That whole book, that whole project, the book and film project, was funded by the same foundation registered that 350 operates under, what's it called now, the Sustainable Markets Foundation. And the website, even 350.org, is registered to, I believe it's Jay Halton of that Sustainable Markets Foundation, which funded the Book and Film Project, which is also funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, goes on and on. So what you're getting is not radical movements, you know, coming together, environmentalism, anything like this, with true environmentalists. You're getting exactly what's been packaged and designed by foundations who have everything packaged and waiting in the wings for us. I mean, these NGOs are extensions of the state, they're extension of the oligarchy, and they're not real movements. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you go to 350.org, that organization began as Step It Up. We're going way back now. I'm not sure. I don't have my notes or my articles in front of me. But I think back to around 2007, and then it morphed into One Sky, which was an incubator project, which a lot of these NGOs are an incubator project of the Rockefeller Foundation. And then it was funded and taken under the wings of the Clinton Foundation. And then in 2011, on 350.org was operating under another banner, and that became the one that really, you know, became a powerful force of connecting with people. So they went with that one, and then they merged the two together. And then since then, it's a multi-million-dollar force, you know, funded by, I mean, not all the funders are even disclosed. Some people they won't even disclose, but it's, you know, it's a huge way to manipulate the populace.
Yeah.
Without being directly involved. I mean, it looks like separate entities. The oligarchs over here, the foundations over here, right? All funneling money from the corporations into the foundation, into the NGOs. But it's all in, the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In this huge, these trillions of dollars that are funded into the nonprofit industrial complex, it creates a very, very successful form of self-censorship. I mean, you don't even have to be told what to say and not say, right? It's automatically understood. If you don't toe the line, you're kissing, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of funding away.
Mm. I see that you, in one of your previous articles for Counterpunch, you quoted in a February 2013 article you wrote, and you quoted from a Financial Post article which talked about the Rockefellers' involvement, and said in that article it said that since 2007 the Rockefellers have paid
$4 million U.S. towards OneSky and 350.org tax returns, say. And the Schumann Center provided $1.5 million U.S. to McGibbon's three campaigns, as well as $2.7 million U.S. to fund the environmental journalism program at Middlebury College in Vermont, where McGibbon is on staff, and that their list of 350.org's list of donors fails to convey is that some foundations provide only $5,000 to $10,000 US, while two unidentified donors provide half of 350.org's budget for 2011, according to financial statements. Now, you know, if we're talking about these, you know, like Rockefellers, like the 1% of the 1% of the 1%, it seems hard to believe that they're interested in dismantling this capitalist economic order in any significant way. So, what is their game here?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, this is all about power, and this is about keeping the system intact for those who it serves, which are the most, you know, obviously the rich and the powerful. And so, the nonprofit industrial complex is set up as this wall to sort of protect this power structure. It insulates it, it protects it, and even more than that, it allows it to expand. And so going back to what you were speaking about a few minutes ago, Klein's book, Climate, what's called Capitalism versus Climate or whatever, that book project and film project, well, that is, you know, the irony is she doesn't actually... I mean, if you go to, here's a fellow from Australia, an activist named Michael Swift, does really great research and a bit of writing and following these NGOs. And he says, you know, she never says we have to dismantle capitalism. It's not about dismantling capitalism. That's what she says. And the point is basically the whole divestment campaign. Right now, you know, according to, and it's been going this way for a couple years, and even longer, you know, you can see all these articles at the McKinsey Institute, blah, 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 about, you know, the global economy has become stagnant. There's nowhere else to grow. Under this capitalist system, we have to keep expanding. We have to keep growing. Well, we've hit, as Larry Summers says from Goldman Sachs last October, we're flying close to stall speed. You know, the World Bank has said the greatest threat to the world basically is, you know, stagnant growth. We have to keep growing. If we don't grow, we collapse under this system. And so here we have the, you know, one of the few opportunities in recent history where our system, the capitalist system, is actually teetering on the brink of collapse. So if we're really serious that it's climate or capitalism, this is the time to dismantle. Right, to start dismantling and thinking how are we going to replace this system into a living, you know, reasonable living arrangement. But instead, we are told we're going to divest and invest, and all this does is protect the system from collapse. We're trying to inject trillions of dollars into a dying system. We're trying to create new markets out of the financialization of all nature on the planet. Payments for ecosystem services. So they're desperate, you know, to save their power, to save the system that's, you know, basically slowly collapsing.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Could we just maybe drill down a little bit on that topic of divestment? Our radio station here is located on a university campus where there's a major push for divestment of our university, the university foundation's assets away from fossil fuel industries, and that's a major plank of the whole 350.org and their affiliate organizations. And on the surface, it seems like a responsible thing to do. Like you reflect on South Africa and how boycotting South African companies was help bring down racist apartheid, maybe not economic apartheid, but certainly racist apartheid. You think about the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against Israel, which seems to be making some kinds of progress. So it's easy to understand how people who are earnest students and activists and academics could get caught up in that campaign. These fossil fuel companies are just exploiting the oil wealth and contributing to the destruction of the planet. So how does divestment away – I mean, how does that contribute to this new economy? Like, could you give an example of how that is flawed thinking?
Well, okay. So many places to go with that question.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so first of all, about the students and people on campus that you speak of, they absolutely target well-intentioned people. And I mean, so there's no doubt when I'm doing my research and writing these things, this is in no way an attack upon, you know, the people participating in these campaigns. You know, this is what I see as gross manipulation and exploitation of very well-meaning people. It takes divestment, takes the whole emphasis off of who is actually creating this climate crisis. And I can tell you who is creating the climate crisis, something they will never tell you. And it's the 1% of us, meaning you, me, and probably everyone listening to the show, anyone that can afford to get on an airplane. That's this one little handful of people creates half the global greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. So you have a tiny, tiny, tiny handful of people doing almost all the damage, with the rest of the people doing almost, you know, nothing. As far as, and I mean, you will never hear that. Like, this is a huge consumption problem. Where else did I want to go with that question? Basically, right now, what you have, I mean, I try to make it easy. In parts 9 and 10, I believe it is, of my divestment series, I go point form divestment as symbolism, and I go through pointed, you know, bulleted points, what that is, and then I also go through what it's doing. For one thing, this is, to me, probably the most important thing. On one side of the coin, as we are talking about divestment, everyone's divesting, you have private equity firms and hedge funds buying up all the oil. You have Exxon buying back all their shares. I mean, it makes sense. Everyone's trying to grab what's left, right? Even the resource wars, Libya, Syria, all over the world, we're seeing resource wars for what's left. Why? To maintain this Western lifestyle. We have everyone buying up, corporations buying up all the water. And so why would the elites not want to have full control over what's left of all the fossil fuels? The so-called green economy, based on a third industrial revolution, even though scientists have told us we will no longer have any resources even left by 2030, is completely based on further pillaging of the planet. Like, I don't even know where these resources would come, right? Come from.
When I hear about the new economy, I think that the images that come to mind are windmills and solar panels and like electric cars and that sort of thing. And so what?
Yeah. And I think the point I'm trying to make, but it's just such a broad topic, it's hard for me to pinpoint it in a few sentences.
True.
What I'm trying to say is the so-called clean energy economy is completely based on and dependent upon the fossil fuel economy. So you can never have this, you know, imaginary clean economy of Teslas and windmills and solar panels. I mean, people should stop and look up what goes into one single windmill, let alone at the end of the 20-year life cycle, where it goes. They don't even know. I mean, that's another whole entire industry to be created. So everything becomes about industry. It becomes about how do we, everything, like you started off at the beginning of the show, I think, everything becomes how do we make this into an industry? How do we make money on this? And if we can't make any money on it, we're not going to bother. And, I mean, the divestment, as everyone's talking about divestment, behind closed doors and now being implemented in governments across the world, we have the financialization of nature. And you won't see, and, I mean, maybe someone will find something that I haven't been able to find, but I cannot find one NGO campaigning against what's happening right now, and that is payments on ecosystem services, the financialization of nature, putting a monetary value on everything that's left on this planet, a virgin, untapped market of the size and lights that no one's even seen.
So when you talk about ecosystem services, you mean things like rainforests that are absorbing carbon or?
Everything. We're talking about every single thing that provides a service. A blade of grass, sunshine, I'm talking ants, I'm talking worms, I'm talking every single thing that you can go outside and see. I mean, this is happening now. All you have to do, Google payments for ecosystem services, and up will come millions, I don't know, hundreds of thousands, millions of hits. The United Nations Global Goals is all about the implementation of the financialization of nature. I mean, so the whole divestment thing is such a huge distraction. I mean, it does nothing to stop the exploitation, the plunder, the pillaging of the planet, and in fact, it furthers it. It further accelerates it. I mean, I can't believe at this point in time when we should be saying, okay, we really need to scale back, you know, and reduce. What can we live without here? Like, what can we live without? But instead, now we're going to redo the entire face of the planet, you know, with you know, quote-unquote clean, green energy infrastructure that will just further plunder and exploit. Like, look at mining. You know, look at mining. Like, and, you know, it's an inconvenient truth that we just pretend it's clean and green when you can look at lithium mining. If you Google lithium mining, you'll see stuff that blows your mind that looks like the tar sands out west. Google, what is it, the effects of acid in mining, and you'll see red rivers, tailing ponds. I mean, the list just goes on and on. It's all plundering, but it's framed in such a way that it makes us feel good about our consumption. And like you said before, alleviates the guilt.
Yeah, it's like there's gold in them, their nature. it's all about making money and using this whole process of financialization. I was wondering if you could address this this topic of this entity called Ceres, C-E-R-E-S?
Right. Ceres is American. It's a group I had never even heard of until a few years ago. One of my peers, John Stauber, who wrote the book Toxic Sludge is Good for You, he said, you know, that someone needs to write about this group. You know, it's important. Can you do it? And I didn't really want to, but like everything, you look into it. And, yeah, it really, really is important. And so basically they work with, you know, the Fortune 500 corporations. They're a partner from inception of the divestment campaign. And, yeah, they're just behind the whole thing, and now the Dislight 350 is now an international organization. Ceres has branched off and opened up Asian units. I don't know, I think about 7 different organizations across the planet, and it's all about, you know, sustain, quote-unquote, sustainable capitalism, basically just a huge greenwashing project for corporations. It's just, again, make people feel like we can do this in a sustained manner, and there's just no way to do this in a sustained manner. This industrialized civilization is not sustainable and never will be.
I understand that it was originally an anagram of the Coalition for Environmentally Responsible Economies, and it came on the heels of the Exxon Valdez disaster of '89.
Yeah.
When it seemed like after the Bhopal incident in '84 and then the Valdez, it looked like these extractive, resource intensive industries were kind of on the ropes, and so this. This came out as a response, and as you put it, greenwashing, a way of continuing business as usual, but looking basically kind of avoiding what could have been a serious rebellion that would affect the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back, like you said, long, long, long time ago, 86 or 87, when that whole concept came up. I forget the woman that started it. I mean, but now it's a million-dollar institution, right? I mean, they charge membership fees and use the top 500 corporations, the Fortune 500 corporations, I mean, and basically all the big players on the planet paying huge fees, and Ceres comes in behind them and does all the media releases, you know, works with them on media releases and, you know, basically how can we're going to change and we're going to do this new economy, green economy. And it's just a big greenwash. And all the different, I have them listed in one of the articles, maybe in the one that you're referring to with the Earth Day article. I have listed their principles, and they're all voluntary, right? Like, it's just all more of the same, more of the same. And they're all in bed with the corporations, and they're all dependent on the corporations. And, you know, it's all really one and the same.
In other words, there's no such thing as socially responsible investing.
I mean, no. To invest anything, it has to grow. To grow, we have to plunder. We have to exploit under the system. If you should have thought long and hard, there might be types of things that you can grow without exploitation of people and planet. But off the top, I can't think of any. Under this system, you would move your market. Like, even if you're moving your money from, say, from Exxon into, where are you going to move it? Well, you want to move it where there's money to be made. So, you know, what does that leave? That leaves a lot of other things that exploit in different ways, like porn. You know, porn is a multi-billion-dollar industry, too, but it's not fossil fuels. Based per se, it is dependent. I mean, there's so many different things to put your money in. Apple, I mean, all kinds of corporations that are dependent upon mining. Is that sustainable? I mean, they'll have you believe it is. Right now, you can find fair trade mining. Everything's becoming certified because that's another billion-dollar scheme set up and run by NGOs. Right, billions of dollars to be made in certification. I mean, it all makes everybody feel better. And at the end of the day, we're just racing to the cliff.
When you're talking about investment in the economy, there's a lot of money to be made from war and militarism.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I find it strange. I mean, if these climate groups are really earnest, it seems strange that there wouldn't be that alignment between the climate movement and anti-war and anti-imperialist movements. I remember, for example, during the 1980s when there was a real concern about a nuclear war, there's a quote attributed to the late astronomer Carl Sagan saying that the nuclear arms race is like two men waist deep in gasoline collecting matches. You know, in other words, like militarism We cannot tolerate any more militarism. We got to get rid of it. And as you know, the single biggest institutional producer of greenhouse gas emissions is the U.S. Pentagon, the U.S. military-industrial complex. And I don't see prominent climate activists or hear them making much mention about this imperialist trajectory that we've seen just in the last decade or so.
And I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, Van Jones, who is on the board of 350, he was a cheerleader for, putting a no-fly zone over Syria. I mean, he's a cheerleader for war. It's disgusting. There's no anti-imperialist movement at all. I mean, everyone's cheerleading now over Bernie Sanders, who makes the same promises as we already heard from Obama over in the U.S. And he isn't opposed to all the foreign trade policies that have happened in the past and allowed this to happen and continue. I mean, the Western lifestyle is dependent on these wars, right? And, it's appalling. It's absolutely appalling. And environmentalism today, like when we look, people think these, we're told by media and that these are leaders. They're not leaders. They're cherry-picked and they're groomed and they're appointed by the establishment. And they're not activists at all. And they will never talk about the military-industrial complex because they know that's not to be spoken of. And they're all in bed with the Democrats in the States, and they're all, the Dems are just as pro-war as anybody. And, yeah, it's appalling. I mean, everyone in the so-called left is up to their neck in blood of Libyan people, Syrian people, and just it goes on and on all over the world. And that has to be, that should be the very foundation of all movements. And it's just a tragedy. This whole movement is completely, you've got this hum, this flow of racism that just thrives beneath the movement and hums along beneath the movement.
Speaking of that, on that topic, one of the articles you wrote was called The Most Important Cop Briefing That You Never Heard Of, and it refers to the what happened in the, I think it was the COP, the 2009 conference, in which essentially a lot of the African countries and countries in the global south were appealing for a much more ambitious climate target than what these the mainstream and non-governmental organizations were pushing for. Could you address that point?
Yeah. Like, we knew way back in 1990, the United Nations actually had a group called the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases. And I came across something that mentioned this paper in my research a few years ago, and this paper was nowhere to be found, so I ended up I'm not sure if I called on the telephone or how I contacted them, but I got in touch with an institute that had this paper, and they actually mailed it to me, and it was huge, and I had it put into two PDF files, and now I have it online for people to read. Anyway, back in 1990, I mean, they stated at that time that 1 degree was going too far, right? And already, obviously, today, people knew that back then, and now today we're quote-unquote demanding two degrees, or demanding that we don't go past 2 degrees. Anyway, back at the COP15, I was at that conference, and I probably would never go to another one, because now that I say it's completely futile, I wouldn't waste the carbon. But anyway, I'm glad in retrospect that I was at that one, because I was able to record the speech given by the representative of the G77. And what happened there, right before that COP conference, there was a huge campaign that came about, and people listening to your show may remember it. It was called Tick, Tick, Tick. And it just came out of nowhere, and it wasn't until after the conference when I started doing the research I found out what this was, and it was a... Or Tick, Tick, Tick came, it's also called the GCCA, and it's an organization of 20 groups, including Greenpeace, Oxfam, 350.org, and 17 others, and they basically created, with the largest advertising agency in the world, this Tick, Tick, Tick campaign, and they collected, which is a huge part of the NGOs, the nonprofit industrial complex, is collecting data and email addresses. So anyway, they collected, I don't know, 14 million names before, you know, and by way of a petition before that conference. And you had little islands, you had the nations that were really on the front lines of climate change demanding, you know, real targets. Bolivia was probably at the forefront. They were making real demands, and they were demanding the radical and necessary emission cuts that we really needed. And in this one instance, the representative of the G77 that I filmed, I believe his name was Lumumba Dap King, you know, he basically referred to them as the CIA, and I mean, it's a video well worth watching. It's up on YouTube, and maybe when you post this online or something, you can direct people over to watch it. It's also, you know, in my article that you referenced earlier. Anyway, the people, it was all NGOs in the room, all, you know, big shots, representatives of these biggest NGOs in the world, and they actually, when he was done, they stood up and applauded him, and then they left the room and basically, again, demanded 2 degrees, while those on the front lines demanded we don't exceed 1 degree, like the UN had stated back in 1990. You know, so it's just, again, showing millions and millions and millions of dollars spent protecting the system, protecting those at the top, you know, manipulating the populace, pretending we have budgets left that do not exist. Anyway, it's, like I said, it's appalling. It's absolutely disgusting, and it's appalling, and that's why I write about it, because even if I can't change it, I'm going to document it.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about that that advisory group report from 1990. I mean, like you say, it's not something you could just – well, I guess you could now because you say you've turned it into PDF arguments. But when you were trying to find it, it wasn't as simple as doing a Google search. I mean, you really had to work hard to get that information.
Yeah, it's buried. I mean, you can even find a Found a Friends of the Earth paper that referenced that paper. You know, like those organizations at that time had that data. And then they go on, flash forward, 25 years to demand a full doubling of that. And why? So we can further grow the economy. I mean, it's all about growth. It's all about growth. You know, if I could sum up the show in one sentence, I would say it's all about growth, economic growth, not growth of knowledge, not growth of respect for our earth, not growth of respect for each other. It's all about economic growth that benefits the handful at the top.
Mm. And growth is it's a sacred cow in our modern Western industrial civilization, but it's also, I think it was Edward Abbey who said that infinite growth on a finite planet is the ideology of the cancer cell.
It is. I mean, look where we're at today, and we're still going down the same road, right? I mean, it's amazing, you know, but at this point in time, I think, you know, we grew up in this culture, and I think decades and decades of indoctrination, it's just so difficult for people to even imagine anything else. Mm. You know, now we're raising a new generation of children who are so connected with their screens and their phones and everything else. I mean, it can only get worse as the more we get, disconnected from nature. I mean, now we're going to assign a monetary value on everything, you know, down to the last ant and earthworm. So everything outside is not to be respected. It's just another thing that you, that's bought and paid for, you know, another thing owned by the corporations.
So I guess we're just about at the end of our time, but I wanted to give you a chance to close. I'm kind of concerned about
where things sit now, because we've seen so much, there's a lot of energy to make a difference, but you know, it seems like most of the people we have been traditionally looking to as leaders are leading us back to filling the profits of Wall Street and other investors. How do we resolve this in our own minds? I mean, how can we? Is there any hope? And if not, what can keep us going in a positive way?
God, that's a big question. It's very, very difficult. I mean, the more you approach the truth, the more you wish to speak to the truth and acknowledge your reality, the more you're isolated and marginalized. So that is in itself difficult. I mean, we're at the point of no return as far as climate change goes. All we could hope for now is to make, you know, to slow it down as much as possible. It's really, really hard. I mean, we're all enslaved in the system, right? I mean, it's a system that keeps us enslaved. It's really, really hard, if not impossible, to break out of the system. And so it works in more ways than one to keep us, part and parcel. So, you know, I think people should try as much as they can to starve the system. I think they should try as much as they can to work outside the system. But I think it's, you know, unfortunately it's sort of like a monster that was let out of the cage, and it's just so huge and big now that we can't possibly get it back in. That being said, maybe it's not the worst thing. I mean, humans, just like all the other thousands of species that we've driven into extinction, will become extinct too, and maybe that's not the worst thing. I mean, obviously we've shown that we can't live in harmony, at least in the West. We certainly can't seem to live in harmony with the Earth, so, you know, maybe that's the way I look at it. It's not really a bad thing. Something's got to give. And, you know, the sad part is, we always think of things in human value. And if we had been different, if we could think different today, if we could put Earth and other, you know, nature, all these other things ahead of human need by direct, you know, we would directly impact ourselves. We would be better off for that. But we don't. It's always human need. And if anything else, you know, gets any good out of it, well, it's a win-win. But really, who cares? We want what we want at the expense of everything. And I don't know. I think we need just to pursue knowledge and step back and start critically thinking. And it's never too late for that. I mean, that's important, right? We need to teach our children empathy, teach them why they don't need all this shit that clutters their minds and clutters their lives. And sometimes I think maybe that's just the best we can do. Be your best and become more aware, think critically, and become more knowledgeable.
Corey Morningstar, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. I found it very valuable and probably one of the best guests I could have had on Earth Day.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I hope I can come back again.
Well, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. We've been joined by Corey Morningstar, independent investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist, and you can find more of her work at the website theartofannihilation.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.